from the Art AIDS America exhibit, Chicago theater artist David Zak, Chicago restaurateurs RJ and Jared Melman, and French actress and singer Irène Jacob. And now here's your host, a man who told you all along the Oscars were lame, Justin Kaufman.
You just don't listen to me. I told you guys, I told you, don't listen. Don't watch. But you didn't. You just had to do it. I was right. Good evening, everybody. It's Justin Kaufman here. It's a download from here on 720 WGN from 7 to 11 o'clock. Excited to be here on a Monday night. Yes, feeling good. Chicago feeling good tonight. We got a great show lined up. What a night last night with the Oscars. It's hard to talk about it almost 24 hours later ad nauseum. It's been every time I turned on any piece of media to open up any link, anything, it was like Oscars. I feel like I'm somewhat lying because I was startled, but at about 2 minutes in, the startle wore off last night. And I'm like, I wonder what's on SportsCenter. This was like, I could not care.
I got deep into the Zapruder film of the Oscars, you know, like really slowing things down, looking at it.
Want to know who was getting what? The one thing I will say, and I really saw this article and I like, it's that the producers of La La Land, one of the producers stopped the show to give the award to Moonlight. The other producer, who was briefed at the exact same time, actually took the mic and gave an acceptance speech. And at the end of his speech, he said, even though we lost, like, tongue in cheek. I love the idea. We lost? We're not supposed to be up here? All right, well, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank my wife. You know, hey, we did it. I can't believe we did it. What a jerk. Like a tale of two producers there. One guy was like, I refuse to get out. You know what? I just want to say, Moonlight, you won this. There's been a mistake. Here's the card, you guys. To the other one who's like, you know, we wouldn't have been able to make this picture and win this award without the support of the network. Emma Stone's wonderful. You're so good. Come on. That's ridiculous. Tonight, coming up in this hour, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy are back for Touche. We're going to argue about national politics tonight. The joint session of Congress tomorrow night. The president will give his, I guess it's call it his budget address, budget priorities. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the crackdown on leaks in the White House. Sean Spicer confiscating the phones and electronic devices of his staff in an impromptu meeting. Hey, come on into conference room. No, bring your phones. Ha, gotcha. And also, the news over the weekend that Donald Trump is going to skip the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which, yeah, whatever. That's actually, I think I think we talked about this on the show last year, that last year's was the first one I watched ever. You always get after the fact, like the, oh, did you see Stephen Colbert? Oh, did you see Seth Meyers? Or, and you find it on YouTube or you find it on Facebook after the fact. This was when I watched on CNN, and I was like, okay, never going to watch again.
I enjoy it and I watch every year, and I like the when C-SPAN actually has the red carpet.
Yeah.
But with no Ryan Seacrest.
Oh,
so
really?
you can provide yourself with your own commentary. Oh, there's a Wolf Blitzer. Oh, that's Wolf Blitzer's wife.
They should do that for all of them, right? They should do that for the Oscars, for the Emmys. So my son said to me last night, when's the Emmys? What? You're watching the Oscars pre-show. Hey, Dad, when's the Emmys? What do you care? You really into who's going to win what TV show? You're really addicted to shows? He really got into the beginning of it because he got the first three right. There were total guesses. He got on Fantastic Beasts, you know, which was a strange way. He had seen that movie and gone with his grandma to see the movie, so he's like, that's gonna win. I'm like, it's gonna be La La Land or whatever I said, and it was like Fantastic Beasts, and I'm like, wow,
he was right.
Then he lost everyone after that. He got cocky Anyway, coming up tonight, as we said, the Melman brothers will be here, Jared and RJ from Melman's the dynasty, Let Us Entertain You dynasty, the two sons of Rich Melman, who have made a name for themselves and stepped out of their dad's shadow. They do so many restaurants here in town, from Studio Paris to RPM Steak to Bub City to Three Dots and a Dash. I mean, down the line, anything that's pretty much on Hubbard Street is Melman or Billy Deck, one of the two. But we'll talk with them about their philosophy behind restaurants, nightclubs, and working for their dad. So we'll talk with them coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also tonight, French singer-songwriter slash award-winning actress. I mean, this is like having having the Meryl Streep of France on the show. Irène Jacob. And in America, we say Irene Jacob. But it's Irène Jacob. She's going to be at the Alliance Française at 54 West Chicago on Wednesday. She's performing music, jazz, and she's going to join us tonight to talk about her career, both as a tremendous, tremendous actress who's been in some, I mean, she's won awards like Best Actress Award at Cannes. She's the real deal. She's on the show The Affair on Showtime, and we'll talk with her about not only her acting but her music as well. And coming up tonight, the soul music of the Right Now, acoustic in studio. How cool is that? Acoustic soul. It's like kind of like Bill Withers, right? Bill Withers is kind of acoustic soul. Al Green, the Right Now, great Chicago soul band, are going to be performing tonight in studio. Acoustics. We got a lot going on. Also tonight, very excited about this. David Zach's going to join us at the big table. David Zach, longtime head of the Bailiwick Theater here in Chicago, but also the man behind Pride Films and Plays. He's done a lot for the gay and lesbian community here in Chicago. He's in the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. We're talking to him about the new exhibit, which is up and through April. It's the final stop of the national exhibit, the Art AIDS America exhibit, which really examines the HIV/AIDS epidemic through art. And it's stunning. It's up in Boys Town, and we will talk with David tonight as well. So that's all coming up. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Stay with us. Here next is The Carryout. Well, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. So let's get the show on the road, shall we? It's time for The Carryout. This is, of course, the nightly segment where I read the news to you at home. You don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, the president is going to speak to the joint session of Congress tomorrow to outline some of his budget priorities. So far, sources say we will see a substantial increase in defense spending and a substantial decrease in non-defense spending. One area that's rumored to see a huge cut will be the Environmental Protection Agency. What's it mean? Well, it means we could finally have those diesel parties on the lake and no one can do anything about it. Yeah! So exciting. I'm going to get so much diesel in my boat. We're just going to be a huge trail all over Lake Michigan. And there's nothing that any agency can do to stop me. It's going to be like the 80s all over again. Powerboat time. Also, cuts to foreign aid, which was a rallying cry for Trump during the campaign. Time for other countries to pay their fair share. Trump sounds like the world's new stepdad, doesn't he? No, Cynthia, it's time for him to get a job and clean his room. No more handouts in this family. No more, son. I hate you. That was South Korea. I hate you. Tonight, CNN is reporting that President Trump signed off on the idea of Press Secretary Sean Spicer collecting the staff's electronic devices to be searched for leaks. It's a new random drug testing, apparently. But the idea that the president is signing off on authorities going through staff's DMs is somewhat idiotic and terrifying at the same time. I mean, how did the White House manage to survive before random phone checks? Deborah, we have a problem here. Were you watching softcore giraffe porn? No, that's a popular YouTube video. Everyone's talking. No, I'm sorry. That's softcore. You know what? You got 20 hours in solitary confinement. Hey, former President George W. Bush was on the Today Show today hawking a new book. When asked about Trump and Russia, he said, "We need answers to some of these questions." But he stopped short saying there should be a congressional investigation. And then he went on to say that we need the media because power can be a very addictive and corrosive thing. Sounds like someone who's in recovery. Tough night for the Oscars last night. Besides the biggest mess up in, say, Oscar history, they also mistakenly pictured the wrong person in the In Memoriam segment. Yep, there are at least two Janet Pattersons that work in Hollywood, and they used the wrong picture. Did someone quit at the Academy last minute and the intern stepped up and was like, you know what, I can do this, guys. I know this. It's my time. You can count on me. I'll do this. I'll do the in memoriam on my iPad, and then I'll take these envelopes. And they dropped them all over the place. A rumor has surfaced that Chicago Public Schools may end the school year early, 3 weeks early, because of funding issues. Yep, June 1st. What's it mean for your child? Well, they're going to be robbed of final 3 weeks of quality education, which is usually plopping them in front of a DVD of Stuart Little or letting them play Minecraft for 4 hours straight. What's it mean for you? Several take your kids to work days before camp starts. That's pretty much it. The Daily Herald's reporting that the end is near for the tollway plastic buckets. You know, the ones that you would loft your change at when you're rolling through an exit. Yeah, that was an art form. How fast could you go and still get that 35 cents into the plastic funnel? Anyway, they're being replaced by touchscreen machines, which in time will be covered by Suburban Band stickers. Try that touchscreen. You're like, this Blue Meanie sticker's in the way. It's not working. In weather tonight, it's official. This is the weirdest, creepiest winter of all time. No registered snowfall for the months of January and February in the Chicago area. Are you serious? It's time to get to the hardware store, buy some duct tape, some batteries, some jugs of water, because it is officially end of days. But it's such a nice end of days. So nice. In sports, all right, let's start with the Blackhawks, who may be the reason there hasn't been snow, because they are on fire. 9-1 in the month of February, now 1 point behind the division-leading Wild for the top spot in the West. It's amazing. I have a feeling we're going to be having hockey in June. Yay! They're hot. Don't look now, but maybe the Hawks are rubbing off on the new-look Bulls. Since the Taj McDermott trade, the Bulls have won 2 in a row, beating the Suns, and then the Cavs on the road. I mean, LeBron didn't play, but still, Cavs on the road. They've worked themselves up to the 6th seed in the East, and they're in shooting distance for the 5th, although they're not very good shooters, so maybe we slow our roll. Fave story over the weekend, swingman Anthony Morrow, who came over in the trade, wears number 1, and he gave it up when Twitter got all mad at him for not recognizing that number was Derrick Rose's number. And it's sacred. Seriously? The Bears just gave Lance Briggs and Charles Tillman's number to the first backup they could find off the practice squad, and we're mad at the Bulls? That's ridiculous. D. Rose is one of my faves of all time, but one MVP and three knee surgeries does not get your number hoisted to the rafters. I mean, Michael Carter-Williams wears Tony Kukoc's number. Where's the outrage? Tony won 3 championships.
Tony!
Come on, Bulls fans, relax. NFL Network saying the Bears will not slap the franchise tag on wide receiver Alshon Jeffrey, making him a full-fledged free agent. And from all accounts, willing to let him walk. I hope they resign him, but then again, in the past 2 years, he's played less than half of the games. If this is the end, where does Alshon rank in the history of Bears wideouts? I'd say somewhere between Marty Booker and Curtis Conway. Right? Maybe throw in a Wendell Davis? somewhere in there? And in college basketball, the Wildcats did the unthinkable and choked down the stretch against Indiana on Saturday night. 9-point lead with about 2 minutes to play, something like that. The loss drops the Cats out of the top 5 in the Big Ten, and with 2 games left against Michigan and Purdue, they are not a shoe-in for their first tournament ever. It'll be interesting to watch how this team rebounds from the devastating loss from this past Saturday. It's safe to say it's already tourney time for the Wildcats. They got to win everything now. Yes. And finally tonight, a new study says that chicken served at Subway is only about 50% chicken. Really? I could have told you that. Everyone knows that. I could have told you that. I mean, that's why I always get the crab. That's the carryout for February 27, 2017. Hey, we bought too many salt packets this week, so here's like 75 salt packets with your order. Enjoy. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roedlinger are here. It's Touche time, Monday nights. Looking forward to it. Also, David Zach's going to join us at the big table. And the Melman Brothers later in the show. It's jam-packed. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well. How about you?
How was the weekend? Did you have a good birthday celebration?
Went to Twin Anchors on Saturday night, threw back a slab of ribs that didn't stand a chance. They put those ribs down in front of me. It's like I'd never eaten before in my life.
Was it food packed? Was flying. Is it always packed in there?
It is. It's tight. I mean, but you expect that, and you go for the meal, and you know, have a couple of drinks.
There's something about the experience of it being there crowded like that. It's fun.
So I heard you talk about the little baskets are going away at the toll booths.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So aside from Big Brother, of course, now tracking us more and more, I've got a little story for you. When I was a kid, I was in the car with my mom. Things were a little tight back then, and she gave me a handful of change to hold because we had to go through a series of tolls to get to where we needed to go. So I said, can I throw the change into the basket? So I threw the change into the basket. We get through the toll, and then we come upon another one. She goes, okay, I need like, you know, 30 more cents. I said, well, I threw it all in the bag, the last one. She goes, that was all of our change.
That was it.
Nothing. Threw all the change in the one basket.
And the vacation was, you had to turn around. You couldn't get past it. What do you do in a situation like that?
You have to go through like a manual lane, and then they write you up, and they send you a bill or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway.
Bringing back good memories.
It is.
Good family memories.
There
you go.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right. It's time for Touché Monday night, and the crew is back. The boys are back in town. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio tonight to talk about everything national politics has to offer, and that includes a speech to the joint session of Congress tomorrow. What do we think? Let's start right there. Let's talk about the budget. Some of the details leaked today, just about an increase in spending and a decrease in other stuff.
It's a big Trump night, and you're going to see whether or not Trump has reached the end of the beginning and is transitioning into some cognizable form of presidential leadership. And I mean that in the sense of two things. A, is he going to enunciate stuff that Republicans are going to support? Or is he going to enunciate stuff where he's going to have some kind of debate within his own party? That's a very big deal. Then the other big deal is...
What would be an example of that? At this point, I don't feel like he has really gone... Against Republican values, on spending.
He is the most liberal Republican since Richard Nixon, and he's probably more liberal than Nixon was. And Nixon was a guy who believed in big government and under whom government spending and the size and the scope of government all increased. And he is a guy who has said as recently as today that he's not going after entitlements. And, you know, everybody who spends 12 minutes with the federal budget comes away, you know, there are certain finite categories, one of which is interest on the national debt. You cannot not pay interest on the national debt. Then you've got domestic discretionary spending. Then you've got military. Then you've got your entitlements. And the big spending growth has all been in the realm of entitlements. And if you're not going to, you know, President Obama himself in 2007 and 2008 campaigned on reforming entitlements because they were spending us into oblivion.
Okay, let me ask the question, though. You know, is this just a traditional Republican conservative budget, or is it, from what we've seen from just the stuff that has leaked out, the increase in spending for military, decrease in spending for things like the Environmental Protection Agency? Is there something different about this turn?
Oh, there's definitely something different about this. First of all, I'm not sure I would call massive cuts in domestic discretionary spending liberal. But what is liberal is, he did promise not to touch entitlements. Apparently, he's going to stick to that promise. And the problem with that is if you eliminate entitlements and you're eliminating interest on the debt and you're eliminating not eliminating defense, but actually increasing defense spending. The number we heard today was $54 billion, but it turns out in Spicy's news conference of the day, Sean Spicer's news conference of the day, that $54 billion didn't include another $29 billion for ISIS, which is off the books, but is also going to be spent. So you're talking about increasing almost $90 billion. Just to put it in perspective, the $54 billion increase is more than the defense spending of Israel, Turkey, and Canada combined.
So where's he going to get the money, though?
Well, he's getting the money by cutting domestic discretionary spending, by doing things like cutting the EPA by 25%. And again, everybody's like, oh, well, the EPA is probably big and bloated. Okay, maybe. But it's $8 billion total. He's talking about, so if he cuts a quarter of that.
But it's a 12, across the board, it would be a 12% cut.
Right, but it's 25% of EPA.
For the domestic discretionary. If you were to take what he needs to cut across the board of domestic discretionary, it's a 12% economization.
But these are on top of the spending cuts that were associated with the sequester.
Can I ask a question, just a layman question? You guys will know this. I mean, didn't he run on the concept of tightening up government and making it more efficient and doing the kind of cuts we're talking about? Does he offset that by putting such an increase into the military? I mean, it's still the same number at the end, even bigger.
Here's
budget,
what happened with the military. The military, and John McCain is, this is not some sort of wacky Donald Trump thing. I mean, the canonical story here is that Obama thought up the sequester on the theory that the Republicans would never agree to it because of what it would do to the military. And then it got into the mix, and then the Republicans agreed to it. And the last time I was with McCain was at a City Club luncheon a couple of years ago, and he was literally spitting mad. I mean, he was spitting at the table at which we were both sitting, in his anger over what the fellow Republicans had done by accepting the sequester with respect to military. And to make that long story short, it's this.
He's picking it up.
When we underfund military, it comes out of operations and maintenance. And so what we have now are fewer operations. In other words, our fighter pilots don't fly the planes as much as they should. And they defer maintenance, which ends up meaning things like you have to cannibalize an F-15 to keep another F-15 going.
Yeah, and I agree with Chris and with John McCain on this aspect of it, which is that that part of the sequester was crazy. It was insane. It was self-defeating. It was destructive to our national security, and which is why Obama did not expect the Republicans to go along with it. But it turns out there's something they value more than a strong defense, and that was shoving it into Obama and cutting down on spending, at least in that regard. But the increase is massive, and whenever we've seen this in the past, when you have massive increases in military spending, you wind up getting massive waste. And so I don't know that this has been particularly well thought through, other than Trump's going to do this. And by the way, all of this is before we even get to what's happening with foreign aid. He plans to cut foreign aid. Yeah. Everybody's like, oh, well, that's great. Well, foreign aid's 1% or 1/10 of 1% of the budget. He's going to get rid of the National Endowment for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Arts. Great. That's 200 million.
These ideological moves, though, they're not necessarily,
exactly.
They're just about, I said I was going to
tighten up. Those are ideological, but you know what? They've been a long time out there. I don't think they're any more considered. I know David would disagree, but I don't think that's way out there anymore. The idea in this country where, we've got institutions from LACMA in Los Angeles to the Art Institute here to Boston Fine Arts. I mean, the idea that we need a $200 million a year National Endowment for the Arts or National Endowment for the Humanities or Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Look at all of the broadcasting. We've got so much broadcasting. And the idea that we need that, I think that's shopworn. That's ancient history at this point, and it needs to go. But I agree with David. I'm not, here the Democrats have been blocking to whatever extent possible the Trump nominees for the cabinet and the sub-cabinet, and the Trump organization doesn't have enough people out for the sub-cabinet jobs yet. So that's a problem on Trump's side. But the result of that is if you go to a place like EPA and you say, all right, what you've been doing with, let's just use round numbers, what you've been doing with 10 million, you're now going to have to do with 8.5 million. Okay, that's about 12%. Just take that as round figures. Cutting $1.5 billion off a $10 billion budget is not trivial.
That is such an ideological statement you've just made. Because you're making it not trivial. No, but okay.
it's a very
okay. Yes. It's not true. Yes, I agree with you, Chris.
David doesn't listen to things I say. He's got his little patois. He's got the talking points from
it's
Tom
not
Perez.
Trivial.
Touché.
It's a problem. Touché.
All right, we'll take a quick break.
Huge problem, because look at what happened in Flint, Michigan. Okay, you want more Flint, Michigans? You do these cuts. EPA, it saves our water, it saves our air. EPA is vitally important agency, no matter how much the ideologues on the right hate it, and no matter how much the new secretary hates it.
We don't hate it, and in fact,
you do hate it.
We don't hate it. You can say that all you want. That doesn't make me hate it. Actually, I love the EPA that's based on science and not activism and phony fake science.
Chris Rowling, Dave Lundy in studio. Touche, Monday nights here on The Download. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got to talk about leaks, media, and the future of the Democratic Party. Sound good?
I'm leaking. I'm leaking right here.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go
right. Vince Vaughn was great at the Oscars. Did you see him with his glasses reading that teleprompter?
He did a good job. He made Chicago proud, right?
He did the thing. He was like introducing the old folks or something. He didn't do the in memoriam thing. That was beautiful, too.
Yeah.
Did you watch?
Yeah, I did watch.
I loved it. I thought Kimmel was great.
Yeah, he was good.
He was really good. Yeah. It was a good show.
I just really was excited when La La Land won the Oscar, so I turned it off at that point. Did anything else happen after that?
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. All right, so let's hit some bullet point things. The media, Trump not doing the White House, the enemy of the people. He's not doing the White House Correspondents' Center. Who cares?
I'm happy.
But can we talk about
good.
Why he's not doing the White House Correspondents' Center?
Because
he has no sense of humor.
Them.
The man has no sense of humor, and he hates to be insulted ever. Remember what happened in 2011 when Colbert insulted him, or was it Obama insulted him, and he like got. Very stupid. I don't know human beings who have no ability to be self-deprecating.
Has there ever been a president who skipped the White House course?
Yeah.
Sure. Nixon.
Okay. Carter, Nixon, and Reagan.
Okay.
But Reagan was in the hospital when he skipped it.
Yeah.
I think
Reagan missed another one. But
it's been since Nixon, since he voluntarily
the
did.
The other media story.
No, Carter voluntarily skipped.
Yeah, but Reagan
and
was
that
after
was
Carter.
After Nixon. You said it was been oh, since right. Nixon. Carter is after Nixon.
The other story about the media is about leaks. Press secretary, Sean Spicer, calls an impromptu meeting. He says, ha-ha, and he grabs everybody's phones. He confiscates the phones. It came out today, CNN's reporting that Donald Trump had signed off on that move. What does that mean? What is happening?
I love this story. This is the most perfect story, emblematic story about this White House. Because Sean Spicer, impromptu, is like, okay, we're going to have a meeting, doesn't tell anybody what it's about. And then as soon as everybody walks through, he's like, aha, give me your phone, put it on the table, and basically tells everybody that you've got to cut down on leaking, and we're going to check your trust level. Do we trust you? Should we trust you? And they go and they check the phones. I don't know what happened with the phones, but he then tells them, now, nobody, if anybody in here leaks this meeting, you are in big trouble, and we find anybody out who does it, and you're fired. And like within 12 seconds, it leaked. It's like, dude. You can't control this. Nixon couldn't control this with the plumbers. Trump can't control this. You know, come on.
Wait a minute. There are different types of leaking, and there are a lot of policy winner and loser stuff. You know, every Washington reporter, after he or she has been there for a couple of years, understands that leakers tend to be the guys or the ladies who are losing the internal battle. They want to go public try and rebalance things and get their point across. And that's part of the give and take. Take it or leave it, that's what you get. Anyway, what's bad is the national security stuff. What's bad is when Trump is talking to the Prime Minister of Australia, and then 2 days later it's in the New York Times.
And I will say today,
and that's
too,
breaking the
I
law
had a little
too.
Head scratch too on the story that came out today. It came out tonight that that no intelligence was gathered from the attack in Yemen.
Right.
And you know, I read that. I'm like, that stuff I don't need to know as somebody. I mean, I think there needs to be a little bluff game in the way of maybe they did. I mean, saying putting a thing out that says we didn't get anything.
Yeah, but the reason that happened is because the White House insists on lying about it. And most of these leaks are happening because the White House says something that's not true. A leaker comes out and says, yeah, that's not true. And it's happening again and again. And every time Sean Spicer makes these categorical statements, it is 100% guaranteed that we have got, which he did. He sets himself up.
Right.
And look, you're going to wind up having this. And I'm not, I agree with you that there are certain kinds of leaks that are problematic, that obviously are illegal.
Which Obama prosecuted more vigorously than any other president in history, for better or for worse.
Sure.
And I think that's
absolutely
probably for better.
Absolutely.
He was trying to
Obama never had to deal with the kind of thing where you have a brand new president comes into office.
No.
There are so many leaks here, and it's not just the Obama holdovers. Obviously, that Sean Spicer meeting, there's no Obama holdovers in that meeting. Those are all Trump people.
No, let us acknowledge, if you're going to cite history, let's be complete and say the press was fawning and adulatory.
They were
non-critical and adulatory. You go back exactly 8 years, look at the fawning, adulatory coverage of Obama from the day he got elected through, I would say, about the first entire year.
And Obama reached out to people. Plus, we were in the middle of a massive crisis. You can't compare it. Compare it to W. Compare it to the coverage W got in his first year. No. W got great coverage at first. It was a honeymoon period. All presidents get a honeymoon period. Reason that this president hasn't gotten a honeymoon period is because of this president's actions.
Okay, no. The reason that he hasn't gotten a honeymoon period is because the press and the establishment in Washington perceive him, I believe rightly, even though he's a little rough around the edges, et cetera, perceive him rightly as a threat. And here is my point on this. He will never be forgiven for having defeated their choice. He will never. No, seriously.
I don't know.
He
man.
Will
that,
never
that,
be
I feel like
forgiven.
That's a stretch.
I'm
it's
sorry.
A stretch. I feel like I would make. I would. I would make an
stretch.
Addendum. Here's the addendum.
Wake
I would make.
Up and smell the coffee. They don't want change.
But who wants Hillary Clinton? It's not like
I'm telling you.
Who
has hated Hillary Clinton?
Let me ask you.
I'm sorry. Barack Obama, Tom Perez, and the entire media establishment were in the tank for Hillary
they
Clinton.
They hated Hillary
there
Clinton.
There is no two ways about it. As compared to Donald Trump, they were 1,000%
for
Hillary.
Oh, my God. You have to look at the numbers on this coverage. This has been studied.
This is revisionist history.
It's not revisionist
history.
And
you are attempting
at the time
to besmirch the historic record.
Quickly,
yeah, which is why they never covered the email scandal.
Democratic elections this weekend, kind of a surprise, a shock. Tom Perez becomes the chair.
I don't know if that was a surprise.
People wanted the party to go in a different direction. And yeah, is it?
No.
It seems like we're
going around in circles. Said it all. If they go for Ellison, I'll never contribute again to the Democratic Party. They cannot turn their back on centrist pro-Israel Democrats. And look, Keith Ellison.
So the centrist
one. Keith Ellison is a supporter of Farrakhan. Let's not sugarcoat this.
He was a supporter of Farrakhan a long time ago.
He has been. He hasn't repudiated Farrakhan. He's never repudiated his anti-Semitism.
Okay, Chris,
Keith Ellison was unacceptable, and he was supported by Chuckie Schumer.
Chris, he was unacceptable to me, too, for different reasons. He was unacceptable to me because I didn't want to have to deal with this nonsense for the next 4 years. I want to talk about the future of the
Keith
country
Ellison
and the future
is
of the party.
Beyond the pale
if we
of talked, American
if
politics.
If Keith Ellison had won, this
except,
is what we would have to deal with
this is
for
what,
the next 4 years.
No, he's your Democratic National Vice Chairman, pal. I got news for you. You're running in a party that hates Israel.
Oh, spare me!
You have a vice chair of the Democratic Party, and you have a president. So
I don't know.
My president doesn't hate Israel,
but he won't come out.
My president loves Israel.
Your president does not come out.
My president is going to spend $54 billion.
Your president has already sold Israel down the river on the issue of settlements.
No, he has not.
Within the first month in office.
No, he has not.
And your president put Steve Bannon, who's a raving anti-Semite and has a history of it, in the most powerful position in the government in the National Security Council.
Got heated up at the end.
Steve Bannon. Had a Jewish co-author for his
Steve Bannon's anti-Semitism is well documented.
No, it is
and he
not.
Called himself.
There is no
all right,
Steve Bannon is the reason that you didn't mention Jews
that
in the Holocaust statement.
There we go, and a nice little whoop. There it is. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, getting at it in Touche tonight here on The Download. We'll see you guys on Monday. We'll continue the conversation in 1 week. Thanks, guys. Chris and Dave are still yelling. I hear them in the hallway. They walked out of the studio yelling at each other.
That's like that Chicago Wolves-Iowa hockey game the other night. Spilled out into the gangway.
Well, let's hope they keep it, you know, just in rhetoric. Don't get physical out there. We got to toss to the news. I don't have time to break those guys up. I can still hear them. They're still going out there. Wow. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. All right, coming up, David Zacks here. We're going to talk to him about the new exhibit, Art Aids America, which is on exhibit. It's the final leg of a national tour. It's at the Alphawood Gallery up on North Halsted Street. We'll talk with David about it coming up here after the news. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, the Melman brothers, RJ and Jared Melman, the restaurateurs, the sons of Rich Melman, who arguably is the biggest restaurateur, I think, in Chicago history. His sons, RJ and Jared, have made a name for themselves outside of the Let Us Entertain You legacy. They've RPM Steak here, Bub City, Studio Paris, restaurants, not just here in Chicago, but all over the country. We'll talk to them about their philosophy and what they look for when they open and grow a restaurant. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. In the segment I like to call Industry Night. That's the name of the segment, right? We've talked to different restaurateurs, chefs, people in the business, brewers, things like that. Industry night, because it's Monday night. They get the night off, right? Also coming up, French actress and singer Irene Jacob. It's Irene Jacob, but that was my French take on it.
I liked it.
You liked it good. You know, she is a tremendous, tremendous actress, and she's in the Showtime show, The Affair. She's in season 3 of that show, but she's also won Best Actress at Cannes. She's done a tremendous, tremendous amount of film, but she's also a musician. She's touring the States right now. She's in New York tonight and tomorrow. She's coming to Chicago on Wednesday. French musician, sort of world music. It's really, really great stuff. So we'll have Irene Jacob. I've done a lot today, you guys. I was all over YouTube trying to figure out this pronunciation. I used the pronunciation guide a couple times. Because I didn't want to be like the, you know, Chicago guys, like, Irene Jacob is on the phone. So I give it a little bit of respect.
She might be on the phone now for a different reason.
Yeah, right.
Please just say my name the way it's supposed to be.
I think she'll like the work that I put into it. So we'll see. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock. The traveling exhibit Art Aids America is currently in Chicago through April. This is a groundbreaking, award-winning exhibit that showcases artistic responses to HIV/AIDS. And presents artwork affected and inspired by the illness. There are over 100 pieces in the exhibit, which is at the Alpha Wood Gallery, 2401 North Halsted Street, Chicago, through April 2nd. It also includes a video documentary that talks to prominent artists who lived and worked in Chicago through the 80s during the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. They talk about how the artists reacted, how they processed the fact that colleagues, peers, and loved ones were dying at a record rate. And what the climate was like to not only create art, but to raise awareness that artists were suffering. My guest tonight is Chicago theater stalwart. David Zack ran the Bailiwick Theater for over 25 years, started in 1982. He put on the famed Pride shows every June. He's currently the executive director of Pride Films and Plays. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical is being produced at the Pride's Art Center, the Pride Art Center, through March 12th. He was inducted, David, into the City of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame in 2013. And he was here working, creating during the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, and he joins me tonight at the big table. David, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
So let's talk about this exhibit. This is a traveling exhibit. It's a national exhibit, but its last leg is here.
Exactly. I think it's people will find it really interesting. It was very powerful on opening night when I was there with a lot of the celebrities or people who like myself had lived through that period of time. There's a lot of stuff that's very humorous. There's a lot of stuff that's very sexy. A lot of stuff that's totally devastating. just in ways that you can't even imagine. So it's really great that they brought this exhibit here because the history is so important for the community and for all of us, really. We can't really know where we're going in times of stress or times of difficulty until we really know where we've been. And so I think, especially for younger people, it's really important to get over there and see it, you know, because no one else can really experience it. You know, you can go to movies or you can read a book or whatever, and you can't really, you know, experience it the same way as you do first person. But it's really important to remind yourself of what that was like and how artists were the only ones who were really responding at a time when nothing was happening from the White House.
How much of it is documentary and how much of it is an art exhibit? Meaning, you know, how much are you sort of following the chronology of what happened in an HIV/AIDS epidemic, and how much of it is sort of celebrating the art that came around it and still is created today?
Yeah, I think it celebrates the individuals who are no longer with us more so than being a chronological exhibit that you would see if you took an exhibit of the plague in London or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressionistic. And that's great. You know, so there's visual, there's video works, as you said. There's a lot of painting. There's collages. There's different sorts of things. One of the exhibits which I was very moved by was a big piece of leather, which came from a gym, from a place where gay men used to work out. And so it sort of looked like the Shroud of Turin, because it just had the shapes of these bodies which had been there, you know, for years in and years out, until the gym had nobody left to work out in, and somebody went in and bought the leather cover to the workout bench. So really beautiful, surprising, scary, shocking, you know, sort of things all at the same time.
You know, it's one of those, obviously the time in history, such a dark time in history, especially the height of it in the 80s. You know, how much of this, and we kind of talk about it at the beginning, I mean, how much of it is, you think of all of the art that evokes emotion, and it really has to do with people who are no longer with us.
Right.
And how fast, and talks about in that documentary I watched, just how fast it came up on the Chicago arts community. But how much of it is recognizing that, and then also, you know, taking joy from the art that was created from the people that may no longer be with us.
Yeah, I think that was part of what we did in the theater. You know, the theater was a great place to bring people together to educate people, because there were not a lot of places where you could find out what was going on. It was a place for people to mourn. It was a place for community. And it was really, really difficult, because it felt like we would do an opening night and then 2 days later do another memorial service for another member of the community. And it all was happening so fast that you would make sure that you got the gay papers every week, because you needed to make sure you checked the obituaries to see who you know who had passed that week, without ever really knowing that people were sick or anything. All of a sudden they would just be gone. And so the obituaries for Windy City Times, the gay papers of the Times, were just these huge, you know, relatively huge sections of paragraphs about people who you just saw the week before, you know, at Treasure Island or something, and all of a sudden they're gone. So it was a really difficult time for all of us. I never thought I'd be 40. I never thought I would know anyone who is 40. I just assumed that the whole group of us who are working were going to be gone. And so that drives a different sort of thing. You just grieved. I was grieving, and I just threw everything into my work and just sort of said, well, there's no worry. You know, we don't have to worry about the future. Let's just do the important stuff. Let's do the art. Let's do the plays. Let's get people in here, and let's communicate with people. And that's a great power. It's a great fury.
David Zack is a longtime theater artist here in Chicago. He is right now the executive director of Pride Films and Plays, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. The musical is being produced at the Pride Arts Center through March 12th. He's also a member of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame 2013. We're talking about the Art AIDS America exhibit, which is currently on display at the Alpha Wood Gallery, 2401 North Halsted Street, through April 2nd. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. David Zack, we'll go back to the 80s with David Zack here on The Download. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the traveling exhibit Art AIDS America, which is currently in Chicago through April. My guest tonight, David Zack. He is a Chicago theater artist. He ran the Bailiwick Theater for over 25 years, 27 years or so. Currently the executive director of Pride Films and Plays, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, on stage, the musical. being produced at the Pride Arts Center through March 12th. David Zack, of course, in the city of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 2013. You came to Chicago, I mean, or at least you came to the Chicago art scene in the early 80s.
Yeah, I grew up in Lisle, so my family's roots are here, and I was teaching in the suburbs, actually, at the same the high school that I went to, and then decided that really what I wanted to be doing is working as a theater artist. So I was happy to have supportive family and friends. As one of my friends has said, oh, you've never had a job. You've always had your passion.
And what did you do? You just came to Chicago, started working, like,
yeah,
starting acting?
Yeah, like, I schlepped flowers. I was working as a delivery boy in a plant shop, so I met lots of people on Lakeshore Drive, and I would write their addresses down and send them requests for money. And that was good, the beginning of the fundraising part of it. But after a few years, a group of artists got together to found Bailiwick, and that was the beginning of sort of a more permanent place for me.
For you, I mean, tying it together, I mean, this would be the early 80s. Talk about the art scene here. I mean, theater standpoint.
Yeah, the theaters were just sort of beginning the explosion of Steppenwolf would have been, 5 or 6 years old. There was a lot of activity happening. In fact, Bailiwick eventually moved into a great space at Belmont and Broadway. That was the Jane Addams Hull House, which, yeah, I think a lot of people remember very fondly as a place for the Hull House players. And it was there while we were in that building that we did a consultancy with the Kellogg Community Service Group of Northwestern, who said, look, you're in the heart of this community. Why aren't you doing programming that will reach it? Because nobody else is. And you're doing programming like, we were doing classics and continue to do Animal Farm and all that sort of stuff as well. But that was the beginning of the Pride series and the play that we saw at the exhibit, which is mentioned, which is called Jerker. And that was really a powerful explosion for the community to finally see their lives reflected on stage.
This was later in the 80s. Let's stay early on. When you were a theater artist and you were in Chicago and you're working at the Bailiwick, Belmont and Broadway, talk about when the arts community started to recognize that there was an issue.
I think, there was a lot of stuff happening in New York that was very confusing for everyone. There were a lot of really high-profile deaths. There were a lot of high-profile people who were passing. And the frustration was just the attitude of the government, as captured in The Normal Heart, the great works of Larry Kramer. There just wasn't a way for people to really understand what was happening or how to prevent it. And so I think people are really angry about that period of time when so many lives could have been saved if people would have just told the truth and not tried to put some sort of weird, spin on what, how AIDS was transmitted or any of that sort of stuff. So I think there was a lot of frustration. There was a lot of anger. And I think the artists were then able to channel that through Danny Sotomayor's cartoons, people who were writing various, pieces of protest work and eventually works for the stage. And what's great about the theater is can respond very quickly. Unlike television or movies, which take years to get produced, theater artists can see that there's something happening now and they can write a play that can be ready in a couple months, and you can get it up before an audience really quickly. And that still is a way in which art and theater artists impact the discussion of cultural life in Chicago.
Yeah, it's interesting because, as we talk about the idea of having something so destructive like HIV, AIDS in a community, in the gay and lesbian community, but also in the arts community, and how you were able to create art out of it. When you think back to that time, do you think that you were... as an artist, you were prolific, that you had more sort of artistic output because of the fact that there was this thing that was bringing people together?
I think so. I think we had that opportunity because we had a great space. We had a great location. We had an audience that was literally right outside our door. It wasn't as if we had to look for people. So Jerker, you would just open the doors to the theater and the line would be around the block because people just had not experienced anything like this. I mean, it was funny, it was sexy, it was a really great, initially a radio play, but it just had this ending, which was clearly, clearly tragic. And just
talk about it. It was Robert Chesney, is that
right? Yeah, Robert Chesley. Yeah, it just is a great play still. We might be doing a reading of it later this year as part of an anniversary project we're working on. But it just is a series of phone calls between two men. And so it was back in that day when people actually talked to each other when they were when they were flirting, not the app days that we are in now where you just see pictures. And so you really see these two strangers. They don't really know anything about each other, really. They never meet in person. There's a phone call. It's sort of a fantasy where one guy sort of talks about what they could be like, this two princes who run naked through the woods and enjoy life together. And eventually the phone calls stop. So one guy keeps calling and there's an answering machine, and the second call, another answering machine, the third call, an answering machine, the fourth call, the line's been disconnected, and that's the end of the story. You don't know what happened, although, of course, we know what happened. You know, it's that period when people were just disappearing.
Yeah.
People were just...
Why do you think that there were lines around the corner?
Oh, because people didn't have a place to talk to each other yet. There wasn't that sense of community. We didn't have Glee. We didn't have, you know, Riverdale. There weren't any TV shows or, you know, we didn't grow up with gay characters on television or in the movies at all. So it was really great to see gay lives on stage, and Bailiwick was one of the first places that people could go and see those lives expressed, sometimes joyfully, sometimes, you know, full of humor, sometimes through musicals, but oftentimes through dramas that were just really painful to sit through. So a lot of it was really, really great. There's a wonderful play from Canada called Flesh and Blood, in which has a very tragic ending. And I just remember night after night, I remember Essie Cupp sitting there one night for the old days, and, you know, the house lights would come on at the end and people would just sit there. There was no applause. You know, everyone was just devastated, because we had shared this artistic experience, yeah, which was so moving, and you just, wow, you just, you know.
And the exhibit goes through this, and like I said, I've been talking about it, go up to the Alphawood Gallery, which is at 2401 North Halsted Street, but it does go about not just the devastation that the HIV/AIDS epidemic had on the arts community, but how fast it was.
Right.
That this was something that was, it's not a grad, there was not, nothing gradual about it. The idea that artists that were working together, collaborating on things, just weren't there the next day.
Right.
And you talked about you pick up the Windy City Times and you look at the obit, and there's people that you were talking to a week ago.
Right. People you would be in planning for, in our case, planning to direct productions or be in productions. And you'd sort of go, what happened to so and so? And, oh, didn't you hear? And, you know, other people were doing other things. Other people were doing fundraising. Other people were doing, you know, really important organizational things. So sometimes I felt like, because I was sort of entrenched in the artistic, you know, day-to-day of the getting the show on up, I didn't do as much as other people did, you know, in terms of being able to start the foundations and start some of the structural things that really, really helped people as well.
And that came out of the epidemic.
Absolutely.
For sure. I mean, Chicago has such a great history of so many groups that came together to bring the community together. We'll talk a little bit about that coming up here after the news. The exhibit is called Art AIDS America. It's a national exhibit that's last leg is here in Chicago. It's at the Alphawood Gallery, 2401 North Halsted Street. We're talking to David Zack. He used to run the Bailiwick Theater. He also did the Pride shows, the Pride series at the Bailiwick. He also currently is the executive director of Pride Films and Plays, and he is in the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame, inducted in 2013. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The traveling exhibit Art AIDS America is currently in Chicago at the Alphawood Gallery, 2401 North Halsted Street, through April 2nd. It's a great exhibit that showcases artistic responses to HIV/AIDS and presents the artwork that was affected and inspired by the disease. In studio with me, David Zack. He ran the Bailiwick Theater for over 25 years here in Chicago. He's in the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame here in Chicago, and he also is the executive director of Pride Films and Plays, which Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical, is on stage at Pride Art Center, and through March 12th. David, we were talking about, you know, just the reaction from the arts community to the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. You know, it's fascinating because a big chunk of this exhibit is about the artists that were able to tell the stories that weren't being told. I mean, the epidemic, one of the big things was, like you said, there was a lot of misinformation. The government sort of, you know, did a lot of misdirection on what was causing this and who was affected by it. And it was artists at the time, through paintings, through photography, through political cartoons, that really raised awareness and painted a picture, no pun intended, of what was happening. And theater had a part of that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting because the intensity of it was so strong. So for my personal life, the first person who I loved died, you know, of AIDS. And it was part of that terrible tension of, you know, you're grieving, you're working, you're putting everything into what you have on the stage. And it was hard. It was more than hard. It was devastating. It was crazy. But as I said, you just never thought there was a way out. It was just this rabbit hole that was really, really a cycle that was really, really, really dark period, I would say, for a lot of us. So you have really great works that you know, Steve Scott at the Goodman was working on, or Nick Petrica is a Chicago playwright who wrote wonderful things. And the initial part of it was sorrow, and the initial part of it was education. And then you got to a point where people realized, well, you could live with HIV. So Bailiwick did O Holy Allen Ginsberg, which is the first play about gay marriage, you know, early on, right at that same point where people were thinking, great, how do we stay alive? And now you're putting this gay marriage play on, which is totally unimaginable to us. But for Nick, who's a genius and is, you know, still working and still writing in Chicago, you know, it was his vision of the future. This is what he thought it could be, and it was great. We took it to Dublin. You know, it's really great.
It's interesting because, especially when it comes to the when people, you know, when gays were in family structures that were very like immigrant families, people come from different places, and there would be an artist here in Chicago who would, you know, get diagnosed with HIV, have AIDS, and the family didn't know what to do.
Right.
And the family would cut off communication, and because they had misinformation as well. Doctors had misinformation at some points, and they would almost isolate.
Mm-hmm.
And you would never really understand or get a picture of what was happening. And it was artists that would come in with photography, like I talked about, or paintings that would give people a glimpse into private situations, death.
Right.
That we were never seeing before.
Right. And for us, you know, we didn't have emails. We didn't, you know, it wasn't the instant communication that you had today. People would literally write a play, put it in the mail, you know, send it across country to a place they'd never been because they knew that you might have an affinity to doing a work like that. Personal stories. I can't tell you the number of plays I read that were just, you know, just so powerful. Here's the story of my partner. Here's the story of my relationship, my marriage, my family, just, you know, devastating stories about kids getting thrown out of their house or people getting disowned or whatever. And it was really a very difficult time to reach each other. You know, we read the New York Times. We sort of had a sense of what was going on. But, you know, reaching people in different cities was difficult. So amazing that we communicated as well as we did back in that period. And amazing that so much of what we created is still being, you know, is still around.
Yeah.
To have been to document this period, because it would be totally different now. People can go online and figure out what it is, what the disease is, what the medications
as an artist
are.
Community, did you feel that need to document what was happening?
Well, we tried as much
for history,
as we
for,
could.
For posterity.
Yeah, sure. You just feel like you want to leave. You want to be remembered. You want to have people say, you know, we were here. And that's why I think it's really important for young people to come in and see this exhibit. It's free, runs for a couple more weeks, and it's a really, you know, people I think will enjoy it in a weird way. It's satisfying, if that makes sense.
There's a lot in the exhibit that's not just about, you know, the negative impact of and the destruction and despair as we've been talking about, but a lot about the political movement. I mean, there's something to be said about how the AIDS epidemic, there was this movement in the gay community that said if you know, we can't count on the politicians in the city hall or downstate or even in the White House to figure this out, we're going to step up and then do this. You mentioned Danny. I mean, the idea of these the political cartoons that were saying something about the political times. There's a way that the gay community stepped up and got a political voice.
Absolutely. And there are great pieces on the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame website that you can read about the various people who really stood up and were captains of the various movements of not only the arts, but also just the demonstrations, the politics, who was moving forward, who was moving backwards. You know, people got elected into the office who we thought were going to be great standard bearers. Not all those people delivered on what they promised. but that's part of life, isn't it? So it's really been an interesting. It's been an interesting time to. This exhibit is a great way to look back at this time and realize how many different things were happening at the same time.
When you look back and it's, you know, to that time, you know, does it, you know, you were an artistic person. You worked at Bailiwick. You mm-hmm. had success and you had success in the 90s and 2000s, 2010s. Does the AIDS epidemic and what happened in the 80s, does it just cloud that time, that decade for you, or is there more?
I think there's more. You know, I think in terms of what I said before, I never thought I would live to be, you know, more than 40 or know anybody over 40. You know, now I'm 61. You know, I've been married for 25, 27 years. I should get that number right before my husband listens to this. You know, and so you have that sense of there can be life after this. And so I think that was a place that many people were able to get to, and people were flabbergasted, not knowing why, you know, person X lived and person Y died. Yeah. You know,
just survivor's guilt, as it was said in the
yeah, it was yeah. totally random. After person, you know, Z who had sex with 40 million people, and person, you know, would be fine, and person, you know, whatever, who had never slept with a person other than his husband was taken away. So still there's that frustration about the disease and you know, how it all works and why it all works. So there was a lot of frustration, a lot of anger about that. But then I think at some point people realized that you could make it through. And that's what I think some of the Dust and Lance Black series, which is starting tonight, right. is about, is that sense of when we rise, when we go through these troubling times, whether they're racial times or anti-Semitic times, if we stick together and bond together, we can make it through and defeat the ignorance or defeat the forces of complacency, which are trying to pretend that something, you know, like the Reagans were, you know, just trying to pretend that this wasn't an issue. And it was dumb because Nancy Reagan had all these gay friends and, you know, they had all their Hollywood connections. It's really infuriating that they, you know, personally were, I think, involved and responsible for a lot of the miseducation, or as you call it, misdirection of what was happening.
You know, it's interesting because with the Art AIDS exhibit that's the national tour, When We Rise on ABC, there seems to be a resurgence in telling the stories of the LGBT community. Why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think it is? And has a story been told in the right way? I mean, it feels like it's a story I know, my generation knows. Has it been told in the right way?
I think it's being told... for the most part, in the right way. You know, there was a movie, a Stonewall movie, a couple years ago, maybe the summer before last, that was not good, you know, because it focused on a kid from Kansas, and he was cute and handsome, and, you know, it was, it had nothing really, almost nothing to do with Stonewall, yeah. but it was called Stonewall, and everybody went out to see it. So I think it's good that you can make mistakes as an artist. You can make mistakes in how you tell the story. You know, none of us are creating the definitive AIDS play or the definitive AIDS movie. But what I do think is that art changes people's lives now because of the exposure to it. So the kids yeah. who grew up on Glee, or the kids who are growing up on Riverdale, or are watching every television show which has a gay and lesbian character, and sometimes, you know, how to get away with murder, and you're like, whoa, what, that's interesting on channel, you know, whatever, or Fox, you know, the big gay love scene comes up in the middle of a Fox TV show. That's crucial, and we have to keep understanding that we just want our stories told like everybody else's stories sure. are told. But if they're told, then people come of age realizing that diversity is good and history is important, and we can't circle back to a point where we're just...
There's a lot talked about in the exhibit just about the sort of the first responders of artists.
Right.
Artists who suffered or died from HIV/AIDS or the work that honored them. And then there's also talk about the second generation, a third generation, and how HIV/AIDS is viewed through the artists who either lived through it, maybe living with HIV, or, you know, had just, you know, it's part of their understanding of their history. Talk about the difference. I mean, as you've been an artist that has been in all those generations, do you see the different artists from different generations viewing and being inspired by what happened in the 80s differently?
I think it's been an interesting progression for people to get. You know, not many people have been through those different decades, and so I feel happy and fortunate that I've been able to continue working in different decades to tell stories from those different decades. And I think you know, too many people only had one or the other. You know, they were in that first group and they left, and you wonder, well, what else could they have created? Michael Bennett, who created Chorus Line. You know, what else could he have done? You know, there's just so many people like that that you just think this is, you know, what a loss that you know, that single loss was, but so many other people like that. So I think it's interesting that the people who did go through all that, you know, for the most part didn't respond in a different way. You know, there's not a really funny, charming Larry Kramer play. You know, the Larry Kramer plays are all furious and you know, and fury. Terrence McNally, on the other hand, is one of those guys who's lasted through the decades, and so his plays are much more genteel. You know, they never were as angry as Larry's, but they have a certain wisdom because he is, you know, one of the smartest guys around and just has lived through it all and really puts that on the page, whether it's a musical or a play.
You mentioned Robert's play Jerker, mm-hmm. and the idea that it may get a reading this year and it might be something that could be back on stage. What's that mean to you? What's it mean to you that a piece that was made in 1989 for a sole purpose to illuminate an issue that Chicago really hadn't grappled with yet?
Well, and I don't think Robert Chesley didn't really write it that way. It was a radio play that was on the air in San Francisco, and people heard it. And again, because it's phone calls, you were able to use your imagination, and it really caught fire with people. So I think he was probably, you know, he had no idea how much of an impact that play would have because he was gone shortly thereafter, with only maybe five or six plays under his belt at that point,
really?
At the time he died.
What does it mean to you?
I think it's great. I think it's exciting. It'll be, you know, it's important. I think it will be interesting to see what the response is for everybody, for the young people who don't know what it was really like, and for the older generation who sat through it. So those make me happy when you can get different types of people. And the work that Pride Films and Plays does is very much, you know, we don't just play to a gay audience. We feel like our stories are important, but they're important for everybody. It's not when you go to Priscilla, it's just old people, suburban people, you know, kids, teenagers, drag queens. It's great because it's just this mix of guys in ties and guys in heels. And you just go, this is what life should be like all the time. Why do we put up such barriers?
For, you know, in the video documentary that accompanies the exhibit, the Art AIDS America exhibit, which is up at Alpha Wood Gallery. You have a line in there that you say, this is what, you know, you want people to know, this is what this was like, and you need to learn from this so it doesn't happen again. Do you feel that younger generations in the LGBT community, or younger generations of Americans, or I'd say globally, are aware of what happened to the gay community in the 80s?
I think they're aware in a general sense, but I don't think they have the specific sense that we would want them to have. I think they don't really understand the price that was paid, how hard the struggle was, how difficult it was, how many people are lost. I'm not Jewish, so I can't imagine, you know, what how that community feels about the sense that the Holocaust can be totally, you know, the people could claim it was just invented or any of that sort of stuff. You know, there's got to be the same sort of frustration that you can't believe that people don't want to know how it happened. And you know, people haven't seen Schindler's List and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's important that if you are anybody who has any interest, you know, if you're a teacher or a student or anybody who can work with young people, if you have kids of your own, or if you're, you know, worried about your own students or children or what their sexual identity is going to be, go to this exhibit and see something which is really important. And it's only a sliver. You know, it's not like it's going to take you 4 days to get through the exhibit.
And
it's small.
And it's free.
And it's intense and it's free. And you might come away going, I have a lot of questions, but that there's a lot of research that they put online, which can give you more information than you can get at the time that you're
this exhibit is truly about telling the stories of those who lost their lives and those artists that were inspired by something that was so tragic. When a younger generation comes up, they may know it, just like, you know, they're being taught in the schools, not unlike the Holocaust, like you mentioned. Are they understanding what HIV/AIDS means or what it meant to a community like yours in the 80s? I mean, because it's changed in the way that it's still a terrible, terrible virus and disease, but it's taken on a different feel.
Right. Yeah, I think I can't speak obviously for the younger generation. I sometimes feel like they think it's manageable, and so therefore not a burden or not anything to be ashamed of. And there's, you know, I understand that. I understand that sense. It's hard, you know, having gone through all the struggles that we went through. And I know a lot of people who are older than myself get furious, you know, at the ignorance or the stubbornness of people who should have known better, in the same way, because we didn't know better, that this generation should have known better and doesn't or didn't. But in any case, that's the bigger question is, how do we work together to get to the point where, you know, the disease can be wiped out, not lived with or not said, oh, this is part of life, because it's a problem here, but it's, you know, devastating around the world. So you just can't ignore it and just say, let's just go out for cocktails and worry about it later.
The traveling national exhibit, Art AIDS America, is currently in Chicago through April 2nd. It's at the Alphawood Gallery, 2401 North Halsted Street. Look it up. It's free. My guest tonight, Chicago theater artist David Zack. He ran the Bailiwick Theater for over 25 years. He put on the famed Pride series every June. He also currently is the executive director of Pride Films and Plays. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is the musical being produced at Pride Arts Center through March 12th. It's also in the city of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. David, thanks so much for sharing your story and talking tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's so interesting. You know, you think about how younger generations are reacting, or at least interpreting might be the right word. You know, because you think about sex ed or just the idea of sexual education and as it pertains to HIV/AIDS from an early time. What were you like, maybe the late 80s? It changed. Not just for the gay community, but for the straight community, it changed. Like there was an actual movement for sexual education. And so, you know, even for us, my generation, I'm 42 years old, you know, it probably didn't happen until later. I wouldn't even, like the generations now, the kids that are coming up now, they're teaching this stuff. I'm not talking about teachers, I'm talking about parents. I mean, just the concept that younger and younger it is ingrained in about sort of the idea of preventing disease and, you know, sexual education. So it's just interesting to see if that is what we're talking about, that disconnect. If you have these epidemics that are just unfathomable, right? If a kid who's 20 years old right now, who's gay, who's living in Chicago, who is up in Halsted Street hanging out at the Roscoe's, or may know about that history, but it's just it's unfathomable. Like, they can't understand what would have happened. Like, the idea that something came on like that, and within a week someone was dead. And really, I mean, it blows my mind to think about it that way. You know, like, I think we lived through it in the way that we said, okay, you know, even being straight, you knew that happened, and you're like, this is outrageous. This is a real epidemic. I mean, you think about even the epidemics of other diseases. You think about Ebola or, you know, other things like that. Everything's so fast, and everything is, there can be an argument made that the AIDS epidemic caught, like, it was the blueprint because of what happened and how it happened and how the government reacted and how quick and how the public health officials had figured it out and all that became the blueprint. So now when there is something that's an infectious disease or something that comes up, there's a whole thing that's set in the order. They're not going, oh, Ebola, no, you know, Ebola, no, no one's getting Ebola. You know what I mean? You know, that's gone. There's no stigma to it. So it's the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, it definitely changed the way we do public health. And then to think about artists being the ones, I mean, there's something that's just such a paradox to be artists were the ones mostly affected, and they were the ones that were the storytellers of it. You know, like there wasn't like they were affected and or it was someone who was living in Africa in a tribe, and we were talking and we all wore hazmat suits and we came in and we with a camera crew and they're like, take a look. The artists that were affected were the ones that were telling these stories. It's a pretty important part of our history, and hopefully not for, and it's still true. Like When We Rise is on right now, ABC. It's a miniseries. So it's interesting to see that there's this just real sort of push towards telling those stories. So anyway, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, very excited. The Melman brothers will be here, RJ and Jared Melman, talk about what it takes to put together a restaurant in this city, the philosophy behind their work. Industry Night is the new segment. We'll just call it Industry. I love that. Love it, right? Industry Night. And we talk to different restaurateurs, chefs, bartenders, people about their craft, about their industry. Industry Night. I'm brilliant. That came out wrong. It really did. Also coming up, French singer and actress Iran Jacob. That was my French. What do you think, Rob?
That was good.
Did you think that you just tune in and you're like, oh, what's going on? They got a French show in Chicago?
Having spent 9 years of my life in Quebec, it's passable.
How would you do that? How would you do Irene Jacob? Irene Jacob.
Yeah, no, you did well. Okay. That's about how I do it. Jacob. Yeah.
Okay. See, I was just going to try to pass it off like it's a thing, but now I'm in my head.
I probably would have had a bit more panache in my pronunciation. But
are you the kind of guy that whenever you come across a French name, are going to give it that panache in the newscast?
You know, I sometimes find that annoying when, yeah, you know, we Anglos try to.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I feel like. I feel like it's just like pretentious to pronounce her name right.
Right. No, you did well. It was good. Right. It was good.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coppin. My next guests are successful Chicago restaurateurs, partners, and, well, family. RJ and Jared Melman are the guys behind some of this town's greatest restaurants and nightclubs, RPM Steak, Studio Paris, Bub City, Three Dots and a Dash, their original restaurant, Hub 51, just to name a few. In total, the duo run about 15 restaurants in the Chicago area and actually around the country. The Melman brothers have restaurants in their blood, as they are the sons of lettuce entertainers Richard Melman, arguably Chicago's most successful restaurateur in history. His portfolio includes Maggiano's, Shaw's, Big Bowl, Emberger, again, just to name a few. Jared and RJ grew up in the business, bussing tables, working the bar, making bread. And now they stepped out of their father's shadow and created their own Chicago restaurant empire, and they are my guests tonight. RJ, Jared, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thank you.
All right, so let's talk. I mean, it's been a while. I've been trying to get you guys on because, I mean, you guys have had such a run in the last couple of years of such great restaurants that are becoming Chicago staples. Let's talk this in this half hour about your philosophy and what it takes to put a good restaurant together. First of all, even though it's in the blood, it wasn't your first choice. I mean, restaurants for both of you guys, you didn't think you were getting into the industry.
I think we probably both realized at different points. I don't think either one of us completely ruled it out. You know, we both worked in restaurants while we were young. For me, it wasn't definite either way. I wasn't certain what I was going to
do. What were you
do.
Doing? What did you think you were doing coming out of college?
Well, you know, like most kids in high school, I worked to have extra money and to you know, fill my free time. So I worked in the restaurants while I was growing up in high school and in college. The only other thing that really interested me, and it was in part because of my dad, he kept me up late one night, or actually I got sick one night, and he stayed up with me and let me watch TV. I saw the Johnny Carson show. The only other thing I considered was possibly being a stand-up comedian, but I got the opportunity to work at Second City the summer between high school and college and realized I didn't want to be around comedians and found myself gravitating much towards the I ended up washing dishes all summer, so.
I was a little different. I think in high school, if you'd asked me, I would have said I'd probably go to law school. I was interested in politics for a short period of time. I had the ability to work on a campaign, and I realized after one day that calling people for money was,
right,
like the worst job.
That's
I
what
ever
you
wanted.
Do, right?
I actually in some ways didn't want to be in sales per se. I think the thing that I like about the restaurant business now is that it is wonderful to give people stuff and be hospitable, and I think it's a much more natural way to sell something than doing a sales job.
As I mentioned in the intro, you guys were around restaurants growing up with your dad. So talk about that experience.
My first job, I mean, it probably wasn't a real job, but we joke about it. I wanted to buy a little camera when I was 7 years old, and my parents told me I had to get a job. And they employed me at Ed DeBevick's, which we no longer own. And it's actually long gone. But so I worked there probably, I would imagine, 1 or 2 days a week for $1 an hour. My dad still has my application, which they made up, which is kind of funny. But as we got older in our teen years, for sure, they were summer jobs, night jobs, anything to make money. And then as I started to leave high school and go into college, I started cooking. And I realized that I loved it and I kind of had a passion for business, the business. And by the time college was wrapping up, for me, it was very decided that I didn't want to go to more school. Law school wasn't an option. I didn't want to go into politics anymore. And started working from the day I finished college.
You guys
much.
Had the chance to go work for your dad. And one of the things he told you, I was just reading in an interview, and he said, if you mess up, you get fired. You know, like that was a big thing, that you didn't get favors for being family. Talk about those first days of getting involved in restaurants, especially restaurants with your dad, and starting a new career that you knew from working in restaurants, but you didn't know from actually working on the business side.
I remember my first day, we went through our management training program just like, every other manager. And I just remember being excited my first day. I remember sitting at a table with the trainer and reading through the materials and kind of learning what my schedule was going to be like. It was a fun process. And I was lucky to have two sort of mentors that were, working with me on a day-to-day basis, the partners that were overseeing the restaurant. And it just was a time when there was a lot of learning going on. There was just – I had always worked in the restaurants. I sort of knew what it was like to be a server or a bartender or whatever. But it was my first experience with management, and it was exciting.
I give our dad a lot of credit. I mean, we – and my parents as well. We didn't report to him. We both had jobs and as low-level employees at the restaurants that we started out at. And we had people that we were – we had schedules we were responsible for and the same rules. And I always appreciate that. One of my things that I liked about my career is that I had an opportunity to first learn to manage. I was living in Minnesota. I went to open one of our restaurants called Wildfire out in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was wonderful to be in a city where he wasn't maybe as influential. We have a lot of restaurants there, but, he's there 4 or 5 times a year at most. He's not there every day.
Yeah, give you a little autonomy, right?
And it wasn't autonomy to be me, but it was autonomy to just work without, him. And I feel like I did a nice job. So, I hope.
Let's fast forward to the work at Hub 51. It's interesting, that story, because that restaurant, which is a great – I love that restaurant, and it's right in the heart of Hubbard Street, which has seen a complete change. A lot of it have to do with what you guys have brought to the area. But it was the first experience of trying to create something that was a little bit more yours, not necessarily let us entertain you. Talk about that. Talk about the experience of kind of jumping into that as brothers and getting to open up your own restaurant.
It it started when I was managing a place called Osteria Via Stato downtown, and you were in between projects.
I had just moved back from Las Vegas. I had opened Joe's Stone Crab there.
And you had like maybe a couple weeks before you were going to be reporting at whatever restaurant you were going to next. And I said, well, come hang out with me. Let's see if we enjoy working together. Because up until that point, we obviously grew up in the same house. He's 4 years older, so we didn't go to high school at the same time. We didn't go to college at the same time. So we were always sort of at different stages of life. But it was the first time we were both working, and I said, come hang out, and you did, and we had a lot of laughs. It was kind of natural. It was fun. I think you gave me confidence with some of my ideas and guidance, and I think – I can't speak for whether or not you enjoyed hanging out with me, but I think you did.
Well, I signed up for the project, so.
Well, no, I mean, so I think it was like at least the beginning of a conversation that, hey, we could open a restaurant together. This might be fun, where – prior to that point, I don't think it was exactly clear. Would we work together? Were we going
right.
to always lead separate careers?
Hub was such a fun time for me, that whole process. It was the restaurant that is probably the most reflective of where we were. We wrote a menu of stuff we wanted to eat. It was our place that all of our friends were hanging out at. Jared was in his mid-20s. I think I was 28 when we opened.
Well, I think when you go from having zero restaurants to having one – you take all of your ideas and you pour them into one, where that's sort of
and some were to that. Dumb yeah. and made us laugh, and you
like what? What do you mean? This, like, items on the menu, or you mean concepts, like, in design? What do you mean when you say ideas?
Like, I don't even know if we should talk about it. Like, for the first Mother's Day, we did a MILF ad. Moms, I'd like to feed.
This was the worst idea ever. Yes. Mothers, I'd like to feed.
And it was, like, we thought it was funny. We were in the middle of opening a second place, and so we just were kind of busy. And
that didn't fly?
We got not go over very well.
Hate mail and hate email and phone calls. And I think I spent the phone that morning, the email blast or whatever went out about it, and I probably called like 40 people back and was apologizing.
And that's part of the business, right? Now you have to apologize. Yeah. You guys are on the hook for this, right?
Yeah, we thought it was funny, and you know, it just was an early stumble.
Well, one of the great things about Hub 51 and reading your story was this, the concept of Sub 51. Mm-hmm. And this is there's a little room underneath the bar, kind of where you kind of cross when you go to the bathrooms down there. And at the time when you guys started, it really wasn't anything. It was a basement. You didn't know what to do with it. So you said, let's see, what about more of a nightclub kind of feel? And it was really your first foray into nightclub stuff. Talk about that. Talk about the experience of changing up, you know, from restaurants to nightclubs in the basement.
You know, it sort of evolved very organically. We had this extra space in the basement, and we knew it wasn't going to be
part of the restaurant,
exactly. And I think we weren't exactly certain what to do. We thought we had our hands full opening this big restaurant upstairs. And at our dad's advice, he said, well, let's put a bar in, and we'll figure it out. You know, I think regardless of what we do down there, it's going to need a bar, whether we make it a party room or a dance club or whatever it is.
We couldn't even decide what wall to put it on.
Yeah, it was.
You know, if it's a square room,
walls in a room, yeah, right. And we looked at it on every wall.
I think we actually put it in the wrong one first.
But the idea being, this wasn't a restaurant. This was a bar. This was a nightclub. This was something.
No, it wasn't
different.
Even that. It was.
It, wasn't, it was absolutely not. We're opening a nightclub. It. We're going to make a room. We're going to put a bar in it. We're going to figure it out.
And we boarded it up. This is true. We you know, put like construction plywood up, and we weren't going to open it. And as we were getting inspected by the various inspectors that inspect a restaurant before it opens, they told us if we don't finish the room, we can't be issued a permit because it's one building. So we're like, okay, well, we got to finish this room, put furniture in it or whatever we need to do per the plan. And we did that. And we still didn't have probably much of an idea of what we were going to do.
Well, no, I mean, for me, I think it was probably 2 or 3 weeks in, and we felt like the restaurant was running smoothly, or we had our legs underneath us. And it, just like one weekend, we had a little bit of overflow, and we said, all right, let's open it up and see what happens.
Put a bartender down there.
Yeah, we put a bartender down there, and it was
servers.
Like, fine.
And it began the foray into nightclubs. In studio with me, the Melman brothers, RJ and Jared, who are restaurateurs here in Chicago. There's so many restaurants, from RPM Steak, Studio Paris, Bub City, many, many more. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do more with the Melman brothers here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, RJ and Jared Melman, my guests in studio, Chicago Restaurateurs, talking about your projects, which are just, I mean, it's amazing to think about the places that you guys have your name on in Chicago and what they mean to the city now. I mean, if you go down to Hubbard Street, Studio Paris, I mean, that is it's one of the, I guess, the most exclusive nightclubs in Chicago. And you think about Bub City, which you can't even peek your head into anytime, you know. You think about RPM Steak and all the other restaurants that I'm not even mentioning here. Right before the break, we talked about, you know, Sub 51, mm-hmm. which was the club idea underneath Hub 51. Mm-hmm. What did that teach you guys about nightclubs? Because up to that point, it was just restaurants. What did it teach you about the idea of maybe doing something else?
I think the idea that we started with was fun. Let's just make a room that we have fun in, that is, fun for other people. And it was an exciting time because we knew so little about nightclubs. We grew up working in restaurants where, really, if people ask for something, you want to say yes. And, you know, nightclubs, you have to say no. Not everyone's going to be able to get in.
And that's almost by design. And that's the success of a good nightclub, with people hanging around. If you've ever been outside of a Studio Paris at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a lot of people walking away who don't get in, right?
For better or worse. And, you know, Sub was a small room. It holds, like, you know, 90 people. So it had the makings of being a fun night spot. And we didn't know anything about it, though. So we just did research. We'd go to every nightclub in town. We'd travel. We'd go to other nightclubs. And we
knew nothing about music booking, DJ booking. You know, we immersed ourselves in that world and meeting every agent and trips to do that. And it was
– what did you not want this to be? Maybe that's a good question, because I'd read about bottle service and your sort of strange.
Yeah, we caved pretty quickly on the bottle service.
There were, but I your mean, first like, thought as guys, you're like, that's something that we don't necessarily want to do. We don't, because that might be a more signal of exclusivity or douchiness, or what is it that, you know, like what is
both.
It that, yeah, what did you not want when you're talking about bottle service in nightclubs?
I think that we, it wasn't something that we were super interested in before we opened Hub. I think we had sort of said, yeah, we're not going to do bottle service. We went out of our way to say that. And within the first 2 months, there were so many people in the club downstairs asking for it, partially wanting to show off, partially probably not wanting to have to fight the crowd to get to the bar.
To anyone who does not understand what bottle service is, the idea of bringing a full bottle of vodka right to your table, I mean, this is $250, $300, $400, $500.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to be pretty reasonably priced. I think we were in
sure
the $200 range at the time, I mean, reasonable or not. But it's, I think, born a little bit out of necessity where, hey, we can't get to the bar, so let's just bring the liquor to you. And it worked. We didn't think we were going to do it. We got so many people saying, hey, can I get a bottle? And it's like, why are we fighting this? Why are we selling glasses of vodka? If someone wants the whole bottle, let's bring them the cups and they can fill it up themselves.
RJ, so, what was your thought on that? I mean, because you guys, I mean, the way that it read,
I thought Jared and I weren't guys who were spending a lot of time in nightclubs. We were going to have a bar. Like as we were in our early 20s, we threw house parties. We were always, you know, we loved having fun. And I think that was
we tended to gravitate more towards bars than clubs. But I don't want to speak for you. I think when we finally came to the conclusion that, okay, let's try it, it was always under the assumption that we were going to bring a hospitality approach to the nightlife,
correct,
that we weren't going to allow the nightclub mentality to infiltrate our restaurants.
Every employee of the nightclubs, as they started, in Studio Paris included, everyone was a restaurant employee at one point. So,
so they went through server training. They learned the food. They learned just our systems and methodologies.
I know I'm not a nightclub guy. Pete's not a nightclub guy. I'm sure a lot of people listening right now aren't nightclub guys. When you say things like, we didn't want it to be like a nightclub, what does that mean? What I mean, because we have our stereotypes in our head of people scantily clad down in the basement of some club, just like neon strobe lights and you know, dance tracks. I mean, what do you mean when you said you didn't want it to be like a nightclub?
For us, it started with just responsiveness of if you called the club or emailed the club, getting an answer back. I think we found that was like,
not happening.
Not happening. Like just places like, they how do I get in? How do I give this place business? We wanted to be transparent or open, that people
to bring a restaurant mentality.
Yes, that we're hungry for your business. We want
you
to
be here.
We all
know that we can't seat every table at 7 o'clock at a restaurant, and we know that every person is not going to get in. But at least, hopefully, every time that happens, and I don't think that we hit 100%, but we try to do that with dignity and make people have a good time and have the approach that we want to help you and have a great time in what we're doing.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll get the news tonight. And I want to come back, and I want to talk about, you know, the concept of what you guys are trying to build with your restaurant empire, like the concept you talked about. You just want to you almost want to create fun or mm-hmm. fun places. And we talk about some of the things that go along with that when it comes to nightclubs, but also with restaurants, about, you know, marrying the two. I mean, that's to me very interesting and things that you don't usually see hand in hand. RJ and Jared Melman in studio with me tonight. They are restaurateurs in Chicago. They do RPM Steak, Studio Paris, Bub City, Three Dots in a Day. I mean, really. I don't know why I even start the list. They're pretty much a large percentage of restaurants in Chicago, good restaurants. Jared and RJ here on the download. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, get the news, and more with them. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, RJ and Jared Melman. They are Chicago restaurateurs, the sons of Richard Melman, the great Let Us Entertain You restaurateur here in town. They run RPM Steak, Studio Paris, Bub City, Three Dots and a Dash. They have about 15 restaurants or so all across the country. In studio tonight, we're talking about, in a way, it's kind of morphed into a conversation about the philosophy of fun. You know, as you guys have started in restaurants and really made a transition into nightclubs, moving on from Sub 51 to Studio Paris. You guys opened Paris Club and Studio Paris, the nightclub above. You know, that is right now one of the preeminent nightclubs in Chicago. That's the one that you're going to go right in the old, right above the old Brasserie Joe on Hubbard Street and be like, just see a massive amount of people.
If they remember Brasserie Joe, they may not be coming to a nightclub.
Yeah, right, to this nightclub, right. So talk about, I mean, there's the lessons learned from opening Sub 51, right? But there's a whole other set of lessons was Studio Paris.
Yeah, I think Studio, I mean, Sub was, it was in a building that we were working in every day, and it's a tiny room, so you could sort of manage it by peeking your head in the door. Studio was the first time that we needed to really build a great team of people to work in the nightclub with, and we were very lucky. We worked with a friend of yours who happened to be great at nightlife and was
so
also...
you guys had to figure that out quick, that you needed people who knew how to run nightclubs.
I think we always knew whatever we were doing, we needed a great team of people around us, and we've been lucky to be able to do that.
Jared and I have said, I think, our whole careers that we don't need to be the best players on our team, that we need to be on the best team, and we'd always rather... you know, play on the Yankees or I guess now the Cubs, but fortunately, but then to be the best players on our team and finding great players to play with has always been fun.
Well, that's a philosophy shared by your dad as well. Mm-hmm. Let Us Entertain You has been a place that has had some of the best teams and been almost, you think about it as like a restaurant chain, like you think about the tree of chefs and restaurateurs that come out of Let Us Entertain You. It's a list of everybody that works in Chicago. Is that one of the lessons that you've learned from being in a restaurant family like the Melmans?
Well, I think it's impossible to grow up around our dad and not develop a deep appreciation for partnership. I mean, it's really what the company was founded on. He started the company with his best friend who passed away many years ago, but started it with him and has had partners ever since. It's what he believes in. It's what he's taught us. It's what we believe in. And it's crucial to our success that we mm-hmm. are lucky to work around great people.
You know, for you guys, when we talk about Studio Paris, and like I said, you know, myself, Pete, the others in the building right now, I'm not usually a go-to, you know, if you can tell, but a go-to nightclub guy. What is it, I mean, in your mind, what makes a good nightclub? What is it about Studio Paris that makes it rise above the others?
You know, when Studio first opened, I think nightclubs a lot of times were dark. They were, you know, they had low ceilings. They were kind of dingy. Studio, it felt open and bright and vibrant, and it just...
It has a glass roof.
Which, you know, hadn't been done in Chicago in a nightclub at that time, at least not to my knowledge. And mm-hmm. it just was brighter, I think, and more open and felt like you were kind of somewhere special. It felt maybe like you were in a warm climate a little bit.
We invest a lot in the sound system. We had taken a sound system that was better. We tried to hire better talent than other people, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then I think there was a group of people that were doing a lot of fun things. I mean, it you know, nightclubs have a very short shelf life. And so it's, you know, it's like we'll say it's like dog years, you know, where if we age a year, a dog ages seven or whatever it is. You know?
I mean, you hear that about restaurants, but nightclubs, it's even probably more advanced.
Probably more. I think
a bigger dog.
There was a magic moment when the club opened and people connected with it. So it's been a lot of fun.
You've learned a lot from being in the business. I mean, talk about all the restaurants and properties that I mentioned here in on the show, some of which are wildly successful mm-hmm. and some that I haven't mentioned that are mildly successful. Right? But talk about the art of failure in the restaurant business and nightclubs. You know, the idea that not unlike entrepreneurs and in the startup community, there are sometimes restaurants come along, you guys put your name on it. It's going to be hot. It's not as hot. Are you guys the kind of business people who know when to fold or when to say, okay, let this shelf life, we're at the shelf life point. It's time to move to another project?
You know, I think what we would say is that, you know, like we try to watch things and sometimes things are going to connect. Sometimes they aren't. And, you know, we want to be responsive if something's real. I mean, like Paris Club, for example, the French restaurant below the nightclub. Started off great, and I think over time not sure it was the concept that people were looking for. I think we got confused in there at some point, and I don't know. I think there's a confusing place where you say, should I work harder and try to make this thing
10%
work,
busier.
Or should we shut down and reconcept and try to make it something that's wildly popular?
We kind of say that being horribly unsuccessful is actually better than being like in the middle. Because in the middle, you don't know which way to go,
right?
And that's better to be dead.
So we don't have like a scientific answer for that, but it's a feeling. And I think about failure a little bit differently because I feel like we have little failures all the time. That's sort of maybe the fun part of the work is having little challenges where you say, oh, man, this is difficult. I didn't know this was going to happen. For failure is constant. You know what I mean? We're constantly trying something, new things, and some of them work, some of them don't. So it's I guess there's two different thoughts there, how you deal with small failures and how you deal
with. It's interesting. I mean, because you don't think about restaurateurs, I mean, you are in a startup business. I mean, do you think about all the work that's being done in the tech sector here in 1871 and other places, and they're starting businesses and trying to make them work? Restaurants is sort of the original, the OG startup community when you think about trying to start these restaurants. And they have shelf lives. I mean, I've always known that fact that, what is it, 5 years? Most restaurants don't make it to 5 years. I mean, when you guys are restaurateurs in a business, especially a business in Chicago that is competitive as it is, do you have to think about an end game to these restaurants?
No. We say that we build them to be there for 20 years or more. And if you look at the history of Les Entertainer, which doesn't necessarily pertain to us, but even Hub 51 is on its ninth year now, that we feel that as long as you keep working at the restaurant, that it doesn't have a shelf life, that it can be open for.
We have an expression around the office, at least amongst the partners, that restaurants don't get tired. Restaurateurs get tired. I remember on day one, Rich said, "Congratulations! When we open Hub, there's no finish line."
Yeah.
And but that's the unique challenge.
You own the business forever, you know, and until you do close. But no, we don't sit around thinking, "When are we going to close X restaurant?" No, we say, "What are we doing to grow it every year? What are we doing to grow it every day? What are we doing?" You know, it's not going to end for us on these places. It can't.
You guys are still young gentlemen. you started in your 20s.
Everyone in this room is young.
Yes. What is the when we talk about the end game, there's no finish line. I mean, do you see yourself staying in the Chicago restaurant industry as restaurateurs, like your dad did before? Do you see yourself maybe, you know, getting out of this business and trying something else? What's the future for the Melman brothers here?
I definitely don't see us being unemployed. So
we need to point out that there's also a Melman sister.
There is. Yes, Molly, right.
Likes to be behind the scenes, but is equally involved and is in D.C. right now. But Chicago is home. I mean, Chicago is really, I think, always where we'll be based.
We are fortunate to have just a great group of people we work with. You know, there's thousands of Let Us Entertain You employees, and we have a great responsibility to them. And to continue to make our restaurants better for them is a huge task and something we love doing and want to do. We did our holiday party for our restaurants the other night. It just was like a reminder of how much I enjoy, and I think Jared enjoys, the people that we work around. So, no, we're not going anywhere, and we're not leaving, and we're going to continue to run our restaurants and do new ones and have fun, and it's going to be based out of here.
There we go. We like to hear that in Chicago. RJ and Jared Melman, two restaurateurs here in Chicago, places like RPM Steak, Studio Paris, Bub City. So many restaurants, it's hard to even mention them all. Thanks, guys, for stopping by and talking to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is an award-winning French-Swiss actress and musician. She's going to be in Chicago on Wednesday night for a performance at the Alliance Française at 54 West Chicago in Streeterville here in Chicago. I'm talking about none other than superstar Iren Jacob. Iren Jacob and her brother will be performing that track we just heard and others on Wednesday night. She splits time as a musician and an actress. She's done amazing work throughout her career and is currently starring in the Showtime hit series The Affair. She's currently in the States on tour in New York tomorrow at Joe's Pub and Wednesday here in Chicago. And she's my guest tonight, Iren Jacob. Welcome to The Download. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences with Chicago. You've been here before, but not much in your life.
Yes, I spent 6 months in Chicago when I was five. My father was a physicist, and there is a big center of research near Chicago, and we lived in Glen Ellyn for 6 months. And then I came back for the film U.S. Marshal,
right,
that was shot partly in Chicago, and I spent a month and a half in Chicago at that time. So I'm looking forward to coming back again on the 1st of March. Yes.
I love the music. Listening to the music in the last couple of days has just been tremendous. Talk about the music, where it comes from, because it's jazz music, and it's also sort of a little bit of a French folk music. Has Brazilian themes. Talk about the new work.
So this is a project we've been pursuing with my brother for now 7 years. We've released now two albums, and it's. He's a musician, he's a guitarist, and he lives in New York. He works a lot with West African musicians, and so most of the songs have this kind of rhythmics, West African rhythmics, but with French lyrics. So you could say maybe it's a world music, because it really combines mm-hmm. different kind of cultures with French lyrics. And the songs are telling stories. It has also a little life on stage that we try to convey. And because, of course, my work from an actress, of course, makes me want to, perform the songs with a little scenography and something on stage.
Well, it's to talk about your style of singing, because when you listen to you, and you've worked with a lot of different, musicians, your brother included, but also, different orchestras and other places. Talk about where's the inspiration come for your vocal stylings, what you bring to the music?
My vocal style will come definitely from, I like the French singer or the French actresses singing. It comes from this storytelling singing where I really concentrate on the lyrics, on the way I deliver them, on the words, and it happens to sing. So this is how I approach this song and this singing. You would say in these songs of Jacques Demy, in his films, there is a lot of actors singing, everything that you would say, can I have a coffee, please? I would love to have a coffee, please. Well, that's the way I approach singing a little bit, like extending my storytelling to a place where it sings.
For you as an actress and an award-winning actress, and it really is the focal point of your career, your music as well, but I mean, you have done so much work, not only in France, but here in the States. Talk about how much you bring of that personality, what you do in front of the camera to your music, to your vocal stylings, to your singing. How much of what you've learned and the craft that you've perfected as an actress moves to being a singer?
Well, I have to say that this is a project that is very personal, that I developed with my brother. And I think this is the main reason that we are doing this project. It's also to do something together. We got along very well when we were kids, and we shared a flat when he was a student in music and I was a student in acting. And so we really dreamt of doing some kind of work together. So this, my singing really is in this project when we meet. Of course, he lives in New York, I live in France, and this is why this music also have this cultural mixity. But of course, we don't do it all the time. It's very exceptional when we do, because he has other projects, and I'm also involved in filmings a lot too. I've done some singing in theater sometimes on plays. But what I bring into this project is really, I hope, being together as an actress, as a singer, with this music, with my brother, with these musicians coming from West Africa, from Suriname, from Senegal, from Niger. You see, it's like, okay, how can we be together and do create an alive moment with the audience that will... that would be sincere and genuine with what we are.
Well, sincerity and also passion and actually being personally connected to projects. I read about that and how you choose what you work on, and whether that's a movie, a stage play, or a piece of music. It seems that you really take time to think about why you want to be involved in a project. Where's that come from? Why not just say, oh, my agent sent me something good to go. I'm going to do this soap commercial. I'm good to go. What is it about you, the way that you choose a role and also the way that you choose a musical project?
Well, it's a very interesting question because when I have young actors coming to me and say, oh, I would like to, you know, to be an actor, what do you think? I always say, you really have to love your profession very much. Because then you'll be happy, whatever you do. You know, because as an actor, you can, turn into readings, you can turn into a little company, you can turn into teaching, you can turn into script writer, you can, you know, also be a movie star, but you can also enjoy being an actor in different kind of personal projects. And as long as you love your profession, you'll feel good in it. And so I think you need, for me, I really feel that you need to love something just to do it and to feel like a personal connection to it. And as I just told you, I wouldn't choose a music project here or there. I'm just doing this project with my brother for that particular reason. And it's this particular project. It's like a personal project.
Yeah.
When I receive a script, I usually don't react only on the script. For example, on this recent series, The Affair, I spoke with the showrunner and she told me, you know, we have no script yet, but I can tell you about the part and you can see the series and see if you want to join us. So, you see, I like the human part of it, how people meet, how people want to do things together, and how they try to tune in.
Irène Jacob and her brother Francis will be at Alliance Française at 54 West Chicago in Streeterville on Wednesday night. You can see Irène's work all over film, and she's also in the Showtime hit series The Affair. Irène Jacob, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Se trouva fort dépourvu quand la bise fut venue. Elle alla crier famine chez la fourmi, sa voisine. La priant de lui prêter quelques grains pour subsister jusqu'à été. Que faire en attendant la saison nouvelle? Quand la famine crie à la fourmi voisine, fais-toi et que le froid en sorcelle.
I could be like a French DJ right now, like a top 40 DJ. Coming in at number 12, En Bas de Chez Moi. That's the record of that song. How great. So great. She's a, it's amazing that, I mean, we had essentially like a French Academy Award winning actress on the show right there. You know, there's a lot of great people there on the show and a lot to still come tonight. But the idea of having a woman who won Best Actress at Cannes on the show, that's pretty great. She's going to be at the Alliance Française on Wednesday playing music with her brother. I wanted to ask the question, and we just kind of ran out of time there, but I wanted to ask the question because she's doing the show with her brother. And so the ultimate question is, how can you do your show with your brother? I'd like hate him after like, you know, maybe like 2 hours. But she answered the question before I could ask that, saying, I love my brother. I love him so much. We get along so much. So I was like, I can't really come back and be like, well, what don't you like about your
It seems like it's more of a sporadic project, though. They're both busy with other things, yeah, right. So they're not with each other every day of the year.
Right.
They have time to get away from each other.
They're on tour, and I think they got like 10 or 11 dates on this tour, so possibly we can get them again at the end of the tour and say, so what do you think of your brother now? Maybe that'll work. I'm gonna try to go see that show maybe on Wednesday because Blackhawks are playing. Wouldn't that be great?
Very fancy.
Yeah, and I'm gonna still see if we can get her to come in and maybe tape something like to play with her brother. Wouldn't that be good?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because that music's so great. But they're doing that kind of thing. That's why we did it on the phone tonight because they're doing that thing where they fly in, she does the show, and she goes. So if we can get there in between their Panera bread break.
Bring Panera over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that could be what I do. Right. What if I bring the Panera to them?
Or maybe Au Bon Pain.
I didn't know that was the correct pronunciation.
Au Bon Pain.
Au Bon Pain. That's good.
Uh-huh.
Au Bon Pain. Hi, I'm here for, is Irène here? I've got some Au Bon Pain. Yeah, I think that would go over really well. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it is time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our All-State Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we strip down the soul sounds of the Right Now. The Right Now are one of Chicago's best and biggest soul bands. They've played all over Chicago. They've opened up for some great bands, Fits and the Tantrums, George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic. Their latest album, Starlight, was released last week. They're going to start a nationwide tour in March, and they're going to be at the Hideout on April 14th. In studio with us tonight, Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Nurgard, and Lucas Gillen, and they are stripped down, a little acoustic for the Right Now. Here is the track, Too Late. Take it away, guys.
Since I've been home, just a couple things I should say when we're alone. You have the nerve to come up to me, tell me how good I look, ask if I'm free. What can I say? Look in my face, you had your chance. Not in my best, but now it's too late, too late. Honey, I can't wait, can't wait. But now it's too late, too late. Honey,
yeah. Ooh, yeah. There you go. The Right Now, Stripped Down Acoustic here in studio. Their latest album, Starlight, is out right now. It just came out last week. They're going to be playing at the Hideout in April, April 14th. Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Nergard, and Lucas Gillen in studio. Caleb Mitchell, Jim Schramm, and Chris Carsali not here right now because that's the idea of it being stripped down. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get some more live music here at Studio 435, and we'll talk with members of the band. Stay with us. Welcome back here to Studio 435 on the download. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with us tonight, The Right Now, soul pop band here in Chicago. They played all over town. They have a brand new record out. It was just out last week, Starlight. We just heard one of the singles off that record, Too Late. They're going to be going on tour coming up here, and then they're ending their tour pretty much at the Hideout April 14th. Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Nergard, and Lucas Gillen in studio tonight. Hey, guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And a shout-out to your band members that aren't here. They didn't get the invite.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the music, the new record. I mean, this is a process for you guys. I mean, this is not something that, you know, you sort of, you know, did it in 2 months and turned it around. We were talking beforehand.
Different humans don't work that way. Yeah.
Talk about the process of putting together Starlight.
I mean, we basically made this record 3 times. no, seriously. We started working with this great producer in Chicago, Neil Strauch, who's worked with Iron and Wine and Andrew Bird. Worked with him in the studio. You know, it didn't... I think we were happy with the product, but we didn't feel like it was pushing us far enough from where we'd come from. Then we made it ourselves sort of at our rehearsal, in our rehearsal space. And then we ended up making it a third time with our producer, Vijay Telesnayak, here in Chicago. So.
Well, I mean, that's so interesting. People who are not musicians, I mean, there's something to capture the sound that you guys are going for and that you have on stage. I mean, it's electric. I mean, it grabs people's attention. It's hot sound. And to try and capture that in studio, it can go a lot of different ways. I mean, there's a lot of different interpretations to it. A lot of producers saying, let's go do this, let's do that. What did you want to get out of the music that you weren't getting from the first try at the album?
I think we were just looking for that perfect vehicle to present Stephanie, our smoking gun or something. I don't know. What are you, Steph? Our secret weapon.
It's not a secret at all. She's right on the cover of the record.
I guess we've got
Rodman, Pippen, Kukoc, and Jordan, right?
Jordan, right.
Yeah, and I think that we were sort of pussyfooting around before and not, you know, putting Michael Jordan on the cover and being like, hey, world, this is what we have to display. We just, I think, both in terms of the songcraft and the production, weren't exactly finding the right mesh for Stephanie and what she has to say and the way she says it. So
that's it, Stephanie. Let me bring you in here. I'm interested in that. I mean, is that something that you relish, the idea of being sort of the front person who's on the cover, and it's your voice, your sound, and the band is sort of supporting your voice?
It was definitely, I think, over the years with being the guy, is a transition to kind of take that lead on. They've always been super supportive in that. I feel like it's time. I'm excited about what Brendan had to write this last record, and that was his focus for me, just because there was a lot of growth that I feel like I've done over the years with the guys, but it felt good to kind of feel a little bit more comfortable in this genre.
Well, yeah. I mean, there is, I mean, the genre, let's talk about the genre. I mean, it's soul music, and you guys come from a long line of contemporary bands in Chicago that are doing great work with the genre of soul. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of soul pop in the way that we're seeing that sort of permeate at the top 40 kind of level. We see that with Adele and other groups like that. Yeah. But talk about the experience of being a soul band in Chicago, because, you know, you guys are doing a soul pop thing, but soul music, I mean, there's an argument to be made that soul music was created in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think anytime you come from a city where, you know, Curtis Mayfield and Chaka Khan and Sam Cooke and, you know, I mean, the litany of soul artists is amazing in Chicago. And we were, I think, talk about this a lot, too. The gospel scene here, even currently, is ridiculous. And a lot of those guys will go on and be playing in, like, some of the biggest bands in the world. So I think, I don't know, Lucas, what do you have to say about the soul scene in Chicago? Let me bring you in here, buddy.
I don't know. Personally, I'm more involved in the jazz scene, but there's a lot of cross-pollination between soul music, gospel people playing like live band hip hop, soul, and it's just kind of everywhere. If you're a professional musician and you actually can play your instrument, you're probably going to be involved in it in 2017.
Do you find yourself as a drummer? Do you find yourself with more roots in jazz music here in Chicago?
I'm not like a scholar of, you know, what roots are deeper, but I couldn't say that. But for me personally, that's where my roots are at. But it's just interesting that even being like involved in that scene, everybody still is affected by the soul music and funk and gospel. It's just like it's all related, and it's just such a strong presence here.
Do you, as a band, do you work together to be inspired by the history that the city gives you? When you talk about artists like Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions, and you think about all of the, and even the, the jazz scene here as well. Mm-hmm. Does the history at all inform the music that you guys are trying to create?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that the sort of epicenter for us was Herb Kent, who just passed away last year. Yeah. 2016. Yeah.
Cool gent, right?
Yeah. The cool gent. I mean, his sets on, V103 on the weekends would be sort of like a rallying point for us as we're rolling back from St. Louis or Columbus, Ohio, or, you know, Nashville or whatever. As soon as we hit within the city limits and see that skyline from the south side and Herb is spinning, you know, something, you know, a gospel quartet record or, something from Quincy Jones and, Patty Austin or something.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It was amazing. It was ridiculous that was a thing.
Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Steppers grooves. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was such a launching pad as inspiration for us. Because you hear those grooves, you know, or those bass lines or those vocal parts, and you're like, oh, those, we need to incorporate stuff like that.
There's something in the water here when it comes to soul music. I think about not only the bands, because there's a lot of bands that have, you know, played soul music and played sort of a rhythm and blues kind of music across the city, any side of the city, right? West side, south side, north side. Mm-hmm. How does it received? Is the music universal in the way that you go to Columbus, Ohio, or you go on tour to somewhere else? And can you feel the same sort of energy that Chicago has when it pertains to soul music?
Greg?
I don't know if I'd agree with that 100%, but I'll tell you this. There are huge soul music fans all over the world, yeah. All over the country, everywhere we've been. I think one of the great things about the Right Now, and especially this new record, is that we still have those roots, but we've also sort of embraced pop. You know, with a lot of the songs on this record. And it's really great for us to be doing that, too, because I think that'll help us reach more ears.
What does that mean? What does it mean to embrace pop music? If you're a soul band and you've been playing in Chicago and you decide on a new direction for the band and you say, we're going to embrace pop music, what does that mean? Does that mean more hooks? Does that mean more?
Yes. Hooks for days. Hooks. I think that was our motto. We wanted to get t-shirts.
You just want to get a catchy something that's going to bring people in.
Yeah. I think it's sort of, you know, you can say what you will about Top 40 these days, but something they have done right is like every, you know, verse from 2016 is like a really good chorus from 1983 or something like that. I mean, every piece of a song is kind of supposed to be ridiculously good, you know,
and memorable.
Yeah. And
I think it's something that if you're at the show, you could be outside of the club and you could hear it and be like, I know what that song is. Mm-hmm. I feel that melody. I feel that groove. Like, it's just so
I can
clear.
Go home humming it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Where I think, you know, the soul tradition, you know, which has a lot of like jazz and blues in it, can have like, all right, we're just gonna, you know, like a Curtis Mayfield song, like it's just gonna be this like chill instrumental thing for, you know, 7 minutes, which is fine, you know, that has its place too. And it's funny because I think we're kind of maybe incorporating a little bit of that back, you know, in terms of a live show. But yeah, for the record, we just want it to be, you know, heavy hitting all the time.
The Right Now in studio, stripped down, Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Neergaard, and Lucas Gillen, the full band. I have the other guys here as well. Caleb, Jim, and Chris, also here. What are we going to hear? Let's hear one before the break.
We're going to do a Postcard, which hopefully you'll be singing after we're done. This is the pop hook for you.
The pop hook.
We're gonna give you a little test after.
All right. The right now in Studio 435 live here in Michigan Avenue, in our weekly showcase. The right now are going to be going on tour. They're going to be playing The Hideout coming up on April 14th, supporting their new record, which was just released last week, called Starlight. Here is the track Postcard. You guys about ready? Let's do it.
It's a shame that I can't sleep, can't dream of you at night. No relief when the day comes, can't stand seeing the light. You've been away for so long, gonna lose my hold on you. The way we left it all, I don't think I can make it through without you. Don't think I can make it through without you. Try to leave in the morning, get out of this house, take a walk in the neighborhood, think about what happened to us. You've been my life for so long, gonna lose my hold on you. The way we left it all, I don't think I can make it through without you. I don't think I can make it through without you. You don't need to write me a letter, you don't need to sing me a song, you don't have to stand out in the rain all night long. I just need a sign that you feel it. Gotta show me you're still there. Just send me a postcard, baby, and I'll know you still care. You still care. Gotta be one of those days. Clouds won't go away. Are you looking at the same sky? Is the sun shining on your face? You've been my life for so long, I'm empty without you now. I've tried my best, but I don't think I can make it through without you. Don't need to write me a letter, you don't need to sing me a song, you don't have to stand out in the rain all night long. I just need a sign that you feel it. Gotta show me you're still there. Just send me a postcard, baby, and I'll know you'll still care. Gotta show me you're still there. Just send me a post. You don't need to sing me a song. You don't have to stand out in the rain all night long. I just need a sign that you feel it. Gotta show me you're still there. Just send me a postcard, baby. Postcard, baby.
Yeah! Woo! All right, the Right Now in Studio 435 tonight. The album is Starlight. Postcard was a track we just heard. Stephanie, Brennan, Greg Lucas, we'll get back to you guys right after the break here. You're listening to The Download on 720 WGN. All right. Thanks, Rob. The Download here, 720 WGN. It's time for Studio 435, continuing our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio. Beautiful Michigan Avenue right here, Mag Mile, right next to Pioneer Court where they're building the new Apple Store. I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a look at that. A lot of construction going on. It's
beautiful.
City, city that works.
Beautiful cranes.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Anyway, tonight in studio, the Chicago band, The Right Now. The Right Now are one of the best soul bands Chicago has to offer. They're playing all over Chicago. They play all the time and open for some great bands like Fits and Tantrums, Parliament, Funkadelic, George Clinton. Their latest album is out right now, Starlight. It was released last week. They're about to go on tour, and they'll pretty much wrap up that tour at the Hideout on April 14th. Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Nurgard, and Lucas Gillen in studio tonight. So, you know, we were talking before the songs about hooks. Is that the goal for you? What's the goal? Is the goal for you guys to create pop music to cross over into radio play? Like, or because, I mean, that's when you think of the top 40 and the idea of playing more pop music. Is the goal to go after a record industry and a major label type stuff and try to get under some sort of radio play situation?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I don't think
Does that even exist anymore?
No, I think it definitely does. You know, like we have friends that are, you know, songwriters in Nashville and or, you know, people out in LA that are sort of pursuing that. But it's a totally different beast.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're all way too old for it, probably.
And we don't necessarily love, like, modern top 40 music. So no. I think that what you're getting at is, like, are we trying to be the next, you know, be our own Max Martin or Dr. Luke or whatever? And I don't think that is the goal. But, Brendan, you're the songwriter. What is your goal?
I think, though, that we all have a really deep respect for a really well-written, a great song.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like whatever context, whether it's in a pop top 40 context or whether it's on a great old soul record or wherever it is, like that's something that that's one of the reasons we're all in this band together.
Yeah. So I think I think the goal is to continue to chase, you know, that great music. If it ends up on, you know, college radio, that's great. If it ends up on, you know, the top 40, then that would be great as well. But, yeah.
You know, for sure, a lot of Chicago bands that come through, you know, they'll talk about their experience and they'll talk about, you know, this being a passion play or, you know, a career in the making, but they have to support themselves with other work, things like that. For you guys, I mean, when you talk about the idea of creating songs with hooks, what's next? Where in the industry you guys fit in? Do you find yourself thinking about a life in music, a life in professional music, where you're doing things like you're talking about, like being a songwriter in Nashville? Or I mean, there's very little opportunity for artists and musicians to break into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But is that, I mean, at the end of the day, do you think about your lives as musicians and this being the sole thing that you do?
I mean,
go ahead.
I do. I mean, that's what I want. And I mean, we all do different things. A lot of us teach music lessons, or Chris, the guitarist, works at Old Town School of Folk Music. You know, Greg is in a nonprofit. Stephanie's in the medical industry. We all have our other things, but we all have this, you know, pipe dream of music being the main thing. And I think most of us have thrown our eggs in this basket, which is a good collective feeling to have. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's hard. It's like finding a group of talented people who are, you know, available and willing to like throw their eggs in your original like band's basket is
absolutely
really really hard.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that, I think what I find with artists and a lot of artists that come in is it's I mean obviously talent's a big part of it and chemistry is the other part, but if you're going to add a third piece to the pie, it's commitment.
It's sacrifice. Yeah.
And exactly. it comes down to this discipline, this idea that, you know, yes, it's, I mean, there are a lot of talented artists and musicians in Chicago, but there's also, you know, a lot of them that are going to bounce around that aren't going to take it that seriously, that it's hard to find, especially a band that's going to have the musicianship that you guys have, having seven deep in the band. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of rehearsal time. There's a lot of commitments. Mm-hmm. Talk about how hard it is to keep a band together like that for that at the size.
I mean, it took 5 years from our last record to really kind of nail it down and all of us together collectively say, okay, we're going to go at this another time. So, I mean, we need a fearless leader like this man right here to kind of keep us all in line and together and keep schedules. He says his main job is to just annoy me all the time and make sure I get things done.
There's a lot of emails.
He does. There's a lot of emails. There's a lot of doodle polls on what are you doing for the rest of your life.
good. I like that.
Yeah, we have to block out rehearsal, you know,
four months
ahead of
advance.
Time.
And
really?
Yeah. Yes. And we all say this. I think every band needs a Brendan. We do. And I truly believe that. I've known him for 9 years now, going on 10. And, I mean, he does. He keeps us kind of together.
But
with
it,
all he does.
It is hard, yeah, because not to toot our horns, but we're good musicians. You know, we all are professional working musicians. And when you're a professional working musician, there are other opportunities other than playing with your seven-piece soul band. Right. And so there's a constant tug of war between devoting your time to the right now and then saying yes to other opportunities that come up that would conflict with it. So it's really just this thing where we all have to do our own internal math of like how much am I willing to, you know, take one for the team or how much am I willing to not be
or other
there
opportunities
for the
in different genres and
Well, and other opportunities to make more money. You know, so that's certainly something that happens, but you know, all seven of us are in it, and it's actually, I always tell people when I say like, yeah, I'm in this band, like it's actually a legal partnership. That
yes,
we're in.
That's another.
We're not just
too.
In a band.
We're a
like
business.
We're like the IRS knows. We're in a
band. IRS knows.
It's legit. So you know you can't escape easily. So just because you know some other better paying gigs came up. So, but it's certainly a big commitment. And I think it took a while to just find the exact right group of folks who were willing to do it and make it happen. And, you know, and we have to have those hard conversations sometimes like, hey guys, for these tours and these dates, like, please, please, please make it happen and do what you
Band
have to
meeting.
Do. Like, for instance, I'm actually missing my first week of my last quarter at DePaul. I'm getting my master's at DePaul and I'm missing the entire first week of my last quarter to go on tour.
I love it.
That's right.
That's it. All right. I'll ask one more question then we'll take a break and we'll get the last song tonight. Yeah. As professional musicians, all four of you, what do you do to make sure you grow? You know, as musicians and you work together as a band, but you also do things on outside, what is it that helps you grow or makes you grow as artists?
Great question. I think one of the things that I do is to say yes to some of those opportunities that Lucas talked about that are just a little bit outside of my comfort zone. In fact, you know, years ago when I said yes to Brendan and Chris about, you know, coming in and playing bass with the Right Now, that was actually something that was a little out of my comfort zone. I was playing like a lot of like world music, playing in a flamenco band, and I still do those things. So it's basically saying yes to something that's just, you know, not what you've been doing for the past 2 years, you know, not just like the gig that you took last week, but trying to, so that's what I think I do to keep it fresh.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's incorporating, at least as a songwriter, just life, you know, into these songs and these experiences. That's the thing I really love about this record. We're not just, I think we focused a lot on relationships before. And then the second record was a little bit about, you know, just fictional things that Stephanie and I would make up for fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is like the third record's more like what's going on in our world. What's
learn
going
to tell
on?
Your
yeah.
story.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think it's more serious, but hopefully more hooky.
More hooky. Back to that.
Lucas, you want to take a shot at this one?
I think, well, one thing I'm doing to grow is getting my master's at DePaul in music. So,
not anymore.
I'm going to get kicked out.
A message
out,
from your teacher. Like, you're out. No.
So I'm always trying to grow from that side of like actual study and learning more about the music. And I try to listen to a wide variety of music. I practice music. I try to go out there on the scene and go to jam sessions and try to meet new people and interact with different people. And I also write music myself. I write jazz music and I write songs too, even though I'm just a drummer. So I'm always trying to get at different things.
Okay. And Stephanie?
I would have to say a little bit of both what Lucas and Greg said. Getting out on the scene, seeing live music. Getting out of your comfort zone. I a couple of years ago, joined a gospel choir to kind of help push me out, and I just wanted to do a little bit more just, you know, learning and growing as far as improv-ing goes, and gospel was the way to go, and met some really cool people and made really great connections. So I'd say a little bit of both, yeah.
Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Neergaard and Lucas Gillen in studio. They are the Right Now. Their album is out right now. It's called Starlight. They're going to be playing at the Hideout on April 14th. We'll take a quick break and we'll get our last track here in Studio 435. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here at Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer tonight. The stripped down soul sounds of the Right Now. Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Neergaard, and Lucas Gillen are in studio. Caleb Mitchell, Jim Schramm, and Chris Corsale. Is Corsale or Corsale?
Corsale.
Corsale. There we go. On guitar. They're not here, but they are part of the band. The band that put out the album Starlight, which was just released last night. You can find it everywhere. And also, they are going to be at the Hideout wrapping up their tour on April 14th. Let's hear the last song tonight here in Studio 435. This is from the new record. This is called Love You Better, The Right Now. Take it away, guys.
Just me in the city tonight.
Yeah! Woo! In studio! Unplugged! The Right Now, Chicago's great soul band, Stephanie Perez, Brendan O'Connell, Greg Nergard, and Lucas Gillen on the drums. That was the track Love You Better off the new album Starlight, which is getting great reviews. They are going on tour. They're going to be at the Hideout on April 14th. I can't thank you guys enough for coming in studio. We appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right. There you go. That's a good band. All right, well, that's going to do it for The Download tonight. Coming up, Patty Vasquez is going to join us, of course. She will have her show from 11 to 2 o'clock tonight. She's got music, live music as well. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, who did all the mixing on the track. And I don't say it enough, Bob, but you turned the Showcase Studio, which is a bunch of old-looking 1980s-type microphones, into a music studio that rivals Music City. So hats off to Bob Ferguson as well. Yeah, there you go. There you go. I say that because every week I'm always like, oh, I forgot to thank Bob. That's always it. So I appreciate you being here. All right, so coming up tomorrow night, we will have the live broadcast of the Joint Sessions of Congress speech from President Trump. He'll be probably around 8 o'clock, Pete. Is that about right? 8 o'clock, we'll do a little pregame, a little postgame. Madeline Dubik's going to be here as well to do our Reboot Illinois segment. We had a good segment. 708 had a great—I have it in my head. I woke up in a fever sweat on Saturday for the name because, remember, we were going to call Madeline's segment like Illinois or something like the state we're in. And then 708 texted in. He said something great like, hey, why don't you call it blah, blah, blah. And I woke up. I'm like, ah, we forgot it. Like, I can't remember what it was.
Did we set it out loud?
Either we set it out loud or it came in afterwards. And I was like, hey, Pete, that's a good one. And then we forgot about it completely. Uh-huh. So if you're listening, 708, we need a name for that segment. But Madeline will be on tomorrow night. We'll talk not only about Donald Trump, but also about the state of Illinois. She had a big op-ed today in the Chicago Sun-Times about what it's going to take to make a grand bargain grand. So we'll talk with Madeline about that. And like I said, the speech, we'll do some postgame afterwards, and then 10 o'clock we'll play The Worst, which I'm very excited about tomorrow night. Claire Zolke and Max Temkin, the creator of Cards Against Humanity, going to be in studio to play The Worst, 312-981-7200. So that's always fun. And then we got the Blackhawks on Wednesday. We're back on Thursday. Blackhawks on Friday. This is downhill from here, Pete. After the band, it is downhill. We got some good stuff coming up, though, in March. It's hard to believe that it's going to be March 1st on Wednesday. But, you know, that's them the breaks. This is Chicago's very own 720, WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Like I said, we will Patty Vasquez coming up next here at 11 o'clock, and she's got live music tonight. I'm not sure what the break. Do you break down all the mics, Bob, and then you got to break them back? We'll see.
The Tossers are coming in.
And the Tossers. All right, the Tossers live in studio. Okay. I like it already. Okay, so that'll be coming up in Patty's show at 11 o'clock. And again, we will be back tomorrow night at 7.